curfew is now in effect. All unauthorized citizens must stay indoors.
Tensions rise as we enter the 213th week of lockdown.
A grim new reality emerges.
COVID-23 has mutated.
Beginning thermal scan. Thermal scan normal.
A horrifying new development
new
today.
New data confirms the virus attacks the brain tissue.
Hey, whoa, I'm immune!
It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling, helping me review this week's news. It's Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers once more. A game we're remote this week, not in the studio because of the lockdown, just giving People's Republic of Stoatscroft a bit of room to get prepared. We hope you'd be back there next week. In the second part, the stealing of the US election. We look at the way vote counts have changed over the last 5 years and who's been behind the change. Is it stolen or not? We will be discussing that. And the big anti-China Hong Kong story. The news networks in the West don't want to talk about it. It's the arrest of Hong Kong State Broadcasting's investigative journalist Choi Yuk Ling. Why hasn't her arrest, which is damning for Chinese corruption, been reported in the West? Do you know why? It's because it's all to do with secret societies and their links to the Chinese state. Publication also of the definitive edition of my Traitors of Arnhem book tonight, suggested originally 8 years ago by Charles Hewitt at Pen and Sword Books in Barnsley in the summer of 2012, after we did our programme with Dave Barmby, which was called A Bridge Not Far, about the Arnhem Battle. But Hewitt changed his mind when he saw how political the book was going to be. My pen driving a sword to the heart of the British establishment and showing how they sacrificed tens of thousands of young British men so their treacherous organised crime network could get their hands on the Nazi gold. The Traitors of Arnhem takes us through the evidence which has emerged since Churchill, Mountbatten, Morton, Browning and other protagonists died. That 10,000 men were deliberately sacrificed in September 1944 at Arnhem, allowing the Nazis an extra 4 months to squirrel their ill-gotten gains away and do deals with us allies. One key figure, Hitler's private secretary Martin Bormann. This book includes my timeline of events, culminating in a deal on the 12th of May 1944, which turned the Nazi uranium underwater, heading in a submarine for Japan around. And it then was heading immediately over 2 days for the coffers of the Manhattan Project, the US atomic weapons program, to devastate 2 months later Hiroshima and Nagasaki. That book, The Traitors of Arnhem, available for free with a watermark at the end of the show and circulated with our weekly email. So you can go to our show page at thisweek.org.uk. But joining me to look at some of this week's news, it's Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Martin, is anything locally or nationally you'd like to flag up this week you think significant?
Well, obviously, we've been all in the US election mind zone. It's been hard, you know, it's been soaking up all of the oxygen. But of course, lots of other things are going on, but we're not really paying attention.
Okay, well, you're right about this soaking up the oxygen. And of course, that's what these endless crises do, isn't it? I mean, we could look at the war on terror, you know, some war that's just never going to end in a very Orwellian fashion. Then we've got the pandemic lockdown, the never ending virus. And now it seems the never ending battle for this election, which is almost certainly going to be stretched out over weeks and going through the courts. The one thing I would say, though, is that listening to the BBC's coverage of this on the World Service, I mean, I, as a journalist, listening to what they're saying, well, they're saying that Trump is lying, Trump is a liar, there is no evidence for what he's saying. Now, this, to me, suggests strongly that we've got news management going on here, information management, in order to try, because normally a journalist, if, in this sort of situation where these things are almost certainly going to land up in the courts, they would be saying Trump's claims. And they wouldn't certainly be saying Trump's lies. They would also be talking about, you know, the detail of what is going on here rather than just these sorts of smears like there is no evidence. You can't obviously say that before it's actually come to court. So there does seem to be a big over-egging of the pudding, particularly by the BBC here, to try and make everybody think, well, Trump hasn't got a legal leg to stand on. But what do you think?
Well, I mean, obviously, the reporting of what's happened in the US is extremely partisan. I've read both stuff coming from both sides, the pro-Trump camp and the pro-Biden camp, which, of course, includes a lot of foreign establishments. But when Trump said he's won the election, that clearly isn't the case. I mean, he hasn't won it. You can say, well, he's mistaken, or you can just say he's lying. But he certainly hasn't won it, and it doesn't look as if he's going to win it as we speak now at 6 minutes past five on a Friday evening. But, the real problem is that what's really interesting is the massive turnout. It's the biggest turnout in a presidential election for decades. And it's whatever else you could say about Trump, he's certainly politicized the population in the United States of America, who basically were so alienated from their politics that half the population didn't vote, and the half that didn't vote tended to be the poorer and less socially advantaged people.
Well, it's what
they will still be. I mean, it's only a 60% turnout now. It's not like a turnout in an Australian election, for example.
But nevertheless, it's bigger than in the Brexit referendum, for example, which was 85% here.
Yeah. Well, in other words, it's remarkable for the US that they've had such a big turnout.
Now, this is probably
quite a small turnout compared to other countries.
This is because of the hardening of the sides that's been going on here. I love this expression, which was taught to me by Chris Milligan, who's the US publisher based in Oregon. And he, what he talks about, Martin, is this whole idea of psychological operations and sometimes ordinary just happenstance divides society. And we've certainly seen that in the US, particularly with the society being divided after this George Floyd incident, particularly into a kind of Black Lives Matter faction versus an anti-lockdown faction. So that may be part of this. What do you think?
Well, I think what you'll find is that on various hot button issues, you've got like a Venn diagram of people who've got different views, but they tend, people who are anti-lockdown tend to be hostile to Black Lives Matter and vice versa to some extent. But of course, in actual fact, there's all sorts of individual opinions out there, and people will fall into one camp on one thing and another camp on another. But I think you've clearly got a big polarization, but it's also a polarization which isn't about much. You know, in actual fact, if you look at the foreign policies of both Biden and Trump, they are basically war with the rest of the world, which has hardly been discussed. And of course, the rest of the world is watching, particularly China, Russia and Iran. And the Israelis, of course, are basically going to get what they want, whoever wins.
I mean, it does look a bit like we're watching the new Roman emperor being decided rather than even just elected from afar, being part of this US empire. And actually, I know you and I disagree a bit on this, but I think that Brussels is also a part of that empire. It's almost like they operate together.
Brussels is a part of that empire. That's why NATO headquarters is in Brussels.
Bad cop kind of scenario. Mm. But anyway, what do you make of this, this whole idea that this election, because we talked a couple of weeks ago, didn't we, about foreign policy. Now, Trump was absolutely clear before the last election that he wasn't going to start a new foreign wars, and he'd done that. Now, that was kind of sidelined. So I wonder what you think the difference between Trump and Biden. Does it make any difference really for the outside world or for domestic Americans?
Well, for domestic Americans, there's probably more of a difference. The foreign policy is decided, just as it is in this country, the foreign policy is very much that in the hands of the deep state. And the president, in fact, is a figurehead when it comes to relating to these things. And there are some differences, but not much.
So do you think the thing is, a lot of people, me included, would look at Trump and say, well, it does look as if maybe he's been pushing back a bit against the deep state to not start any new foreign wars.
That's possibly true. But don't forget, he did go along with the deep state on the Duma stuff. He went along with the deep state on Skripal. He basically was assassinated Soleimani, and it's possible that Biden wouldn't have done that. So, you know, there's two sides to this. But from the point of view of the rest of the world, what is appalling is we've got the military-industrial complex in the US uses the US dollar to extract tribute from everybody else on the planet. That's what the dollar system is. It is an empire, quite literally. In Africa, people collect taxes and that money goes to the United States to pay off international debts, which basically keeps the United States ticking over, even though they're running a massive budget deficit. So in other words, it is a classical empire system. But of course, we don't get a vote in what happens in the United States. And if we're going to have a global empire with the United States at the head of it, then surely we should all get a vote in who runs it. But of course, that's not the case. It just doesn't work like that, does it?
Can you just respond to what I was saying about listening on the World Service? Well, when they're talking about lies in this way, that is not what professional journalists do. If there are claims being made, they're described as claims. They're not just talking about lies. It almost seems as if much of the Western press is jumping on this as an opportunity to really just bash Trump, which they've been wanting to do for a very long time.
Well, there's plenty of hostility to Trump. I wouldn't dispute that. And it's more hostile. There's more hostility from what you might call centrists than from left wingers. Left wingers are not, you know, our attitude to Trump or my attitude to Trump would be I didn't expect anything else of him. But on the other hand, if people are going to be going on about wokeness and political correctness and all the rest of it, and then they're going to scream and throw their rattle out of the pram if people use the word lie, if we're going to have freedom of speech, then the word lie is just a three-letter word, isn't it? Let's face it.
I don't think you're making a very, you know, that's not a good point at all. You know, in journalism, what you do is you wait until something has been through the courts, until you call it a lie, and then, but you don't certainly
no, but call it a lie. It's not the case. When Trump yesterday said, we have won, it's just not the case. They haven't finished counting yet. So he can't just say, we've won. And we know we
wasn't just that. That wasn't the only claim that they were saying this on. I mean, I've never heard the World Service, using these sorts of terms. And all I'm doing is I'm saying, well, as a professional journalist, what you should be doing is you shouldn't be using, you know, in what is coming up as obviously a long legal wrangle to be using these sorts of terms.
Well, and I think that's legal exactly wrangle, what you actually. Do.
That's only one
come back
thing
on that, the long legal
there, Martin, which is obviously he hasn't won the election, but it's normal, isn't it, for people to claim that they have won, even when maybe they haven't?
What, like Lukashenko? But of course, he did win, unlike Trump. Is Lukashenko a liar? I think the Western media had no problem calling Lukashenko a liar. But then, of course, he isn't lying. He did win. Trump hasn't won. He's lying.
Okay. Well, yes, I mean, we can say that. You can say that. And you can use other swear words.
The question of what is acceptable language. Trump has basically decided he's not going to work within those parameters. He uses Twitter in the middle of the night to say what he likes in capital letters. And he's provoked exactly the kind of response from the other side that you might expect. If you're going to use those kind of tactics, we're going to use these kind of tactics. You can't moan. You can't moan and complain. You know, once we've got to the place where people are saying exactly what they mean, I'm not beating about the bush, and that's what we're doing.
Deliberately, completely missing my point here.
No, I see what you're saying about the BBC being hostile towards Trump.
You should be using the word claim, that he has made a claim, not that he is lying, because this is also.
If you're under Ofcom rules, Tony. You can call people a liar in the print print anytime you like. You risk being liable.
It's like you know, methinks that the BBC does protest too much, and that they're being very obviously not even handed. But let's listen now to a clip about the ballot harvesting that's been going on in the United States, because this to me, I mean, I've been looking as I'm sure you have at all these various claims that are being made. By the Trump side, that there have been enormous changes and differences to particularly the postal voting system. And as you know, and I know, that the postal voting system here in the UK has also been pointed at it as being very much more open to fraud than the system whereby people actually go and vote at a ballot box. And there's been an enormous increase in the number of postal votes this time in the US election. And here's why, because of a guy called Mark Elias, who's Hillary Clinton's campaign lawyer. So let's have a listen now to this clip from the Ron Paul show. Ron Paul is a Republican senator, I believe, who was very outspoken about the 9/11 attacks, has been a terrific 9/11 truther. So he's definitely worth listening to, even if you don't agree with his Republican views. So let's have a listen now to this clip from the Ron Paul show, where they look at this whole thing of the new idea of ballot harvesting and who's behind it. Why should it be that the Democratic Party are actually managing a lot of these postal votes across the United States now, where they weren't allowed to do that 4 years ago?
Now, you mentioned earlier the changes in the electoral process in the U.S., and this is something I have to admit basically went under my radar screen. I've always been interested in elections. I was an election monitor for a number of years over in Central and Eastern Europe. I know a bit about monitoring elections. I know a bit about when red flags come up in the processes. There are so many red flags here. It looks like a May Day rally in the USSR. But here's a really important thing that went under my radar screen until I started digging into it today. And let's look at this next clip. I made a joke. I was on RT earlier today, and I made a joke that the same people who invented Russiagate are the people who were counting coronavirus are the people who are now counting the ballots. I was joking, but it actually looks like it's true. This is lawyer Mark Elias. He was Hillary Clinton campaign lawyer. He has spent the years since Hillary lost going from state to state, the battleground states, filing lawsuits to change voting procedures and to bring in this so-called ballot harvesting. What ballot harvesting is, and it's happening everywhere, it allows, it used to be that it had to be a family member who brought your ballot in, and you had to prove it was. With ballot harvesting, party operatives can collect and submit as many ballots as they wish. They can go around, and we've seen examples of this sort of coercion in old folks' homes. They just come in with the box, and there is no process for verifying the ballots or verifying the identity of the person who cast those ballots. That's what he's been doing. But guess what, Dr. Paul? This same Mark Elias, he is the individual who hired Fusion GPS to produce the phony Russian dossier for the Clinton campaign. He's the guy who wrote the check to create the phony Russia dossier. He's the one who's been changing the election rules, suing to get the election rules changed, and he's the one, I would say, that's behind what at least appears to us as a serious question about the integrity of voting. And I really say that as an election monitor. If this were happening overseas, I would throw up my arms and say, no, this is a fail, not a pass.
Yeah. So that's Mark Elias there being discussed on the Ron Paul show. And Martin, what do you make of that? Because it does seem as if the Republican Party have been on a sort of slow burn for months talking about this. For example, in the National Review back in October, saying Mark Elias has spent a career preparing for this 2020 election fight. If they say the 2020 election ends up as a battle in the courts, as many expect, Mark Elias will be the Democratic general directing an army of lawyers in their bid to win back the Senate and take down President Trump. He's the native New Yorker who Politico has described as a quick-talking and Twitter-savvy, the face of election law for Democrats. He's best known as Clinton's campaign lawyer, who paid for the Steele dossier in 2016, and for leading the controversial 2008 Minnesota Senate recount that ended with Al Franken overtaking Republican Norm Coleman. He's the architect of the legal strategy that involved filing dozens of lawsuits across the country challenging state election laws, and basically allowing the Democratic Party to put their finances into going out gathering votes and then even bringing them to the polling booth. So this seems to be a big change since 4 years ago.
Well, the US elections have always been fundamentally corrupt on lots of levels. If you think back to the 1960s, loads of people were forbidden to vote, basically, by all sorts of bureaucratic obstacles placed in the way, which is what the Voting Rights Act, which was forced through, you know, through Congress and then through the presidency on the southern states. And if you look at Greg Palast's work as a journalist, he will show you that voter suppression is still massively important in US elections. So in actual fact, you will find that in posh parts of town, there are very, very easy ways to get to go in and vote. It'll take you 15 minutes. Whereas in the downtown where the Democrat voter is going to live, the black community, etc., you have to queue for up to 11 hours to cast a vote. So the postal ballots this time is very much to do with the difference you mentioned earlier, the anti-lockdown and the pro-lockdown division in US society. In general, Democrat voters have been pro-lockdown and therefore have overwhelmingly tended, in fact, by majority, the majority have voted postally this time, which is new. There's more postal votes than there used to be. But of course, the Republicans have been building up this whole idea that postal votes are invalid, because they know very well that the postal votes will decide it. And it's looking like they will decide it for Biden. And of course, they will then claim that that's not right. But don't forget, at every local level in the US, there are different rules about who can vote, where they can vote, how they can vote, whether votes are valid or not. And it isn't a national system. There's a national system in a country such as Australia, which is a federal system, but there's a national system of voting. It's the same everywhere. Every vote counts. Everybody knows it does. In the US, going back in history, you will find that there's been lots and lots of disputes about elections. There's a fundamental flaw in the system, which is that the Electoral College allows people who've got less votes to win, so it's geared in favor of the Republicans. The Senate elections are completely unfair in many ways, because each state gets two senators, even though they've got small rural states get two senators, and huge states like California only get two senators. So the whole system in the US is rigged in favor of the oligarchy. So when the Republican operatives complain now that the Democrats are fixing the system, it just makes me laugh, because the whole system is rigged. And yeah, of course, I mean, Kennedy beat Nixon
Martin,
back in the 60s by playing the system.
Martin, this is surely a response to those great big queues of people that we've seen in the past trying to queue up, and then the ballot box closes before they get a chance to vote.
Yeah, well, that's what goes on in Republican-run states. They try and make disenfranchise Democratic voters. In actual fact, if you've got any kind of felony conviction in the US, just for a car offence or a possession of dope, you cannot vote in certain states. The whole of the US system is, in fact, an 18th century system, very similar to the British system, which, of course, has not been modernised. It doesn't look at all like modern Denmark or Finland or New Zealand. It's a completely competitive system with a very, very, it's a first-past-the-post system. There's only two official parties. No third parties can effectively exist. In other words, it's basically, a dog's breakfast. And then, of course, the Republicans will complain if they lose. But if they lose, they lose, because basically everybody, you know, the system is rigged in their favor. And the Democrats, both this time and last time, got the majority of the votes in the presidential election. But what Trump is trying to do, and his legal people, is to use the Electoral College to make sure that they win, even though they've got 3 million less votes than Biden. Now, of course, this is not, if this was happening in Belarus, we'd be saying this is, or Venezuela, we'd be saying the government's got this rigged, the oligarchy's got this stitched up, or whatever. I mean, basically, the US is only semi-democratic, and therefore there's plenty of scope for skullduggery on both sides.
Well, I would say it's not democratic at all, because even the candidates are rigged.
Well, I mean, you said the pre-chosen candidates. Which is the real problem, because the primary system means that they can rig the two candidates that you end up to choose between. Yeah, in more democratic countries, anybody can stand for president.
Well, I would suggest that
if you don't get 50%, you keep going until you do, you know.
I would suggest that in the UK, what we've had is a similar kind of thing where Jeremy Corbyn suddenly became leader of the Labour Party. There was a massive, massive campaign to remove him because he wasn't one of the oligarchy's fated candidates. And they've been used to choosing candidates pretty much ever since the removal of Harold Wilson in the 1970s in Britain. And every single candidate from an opposition party or an incumbent leading party in Britain has been chosen by the oligarchy in the UK.
Yeah, because it's what we've got in common with the US is the first past the post voting system, which was deliberately designed to be, a top down system, which would allow the big parties to choose who the candidates were going to be and all the rest of it. Corbyn should have committed to PR, in my view, as you know, but he didn't. And of course, that's why Britain has got a similarly dysfunctional. It's not as dysfunctional as the US, but it is similarly dysfunctional because it's designed to give oligarchs a veto. That's basically what it's about. Whereas, of course, in other countries which are more democratic, I would say places like Finland, for example, you've got basically a left-wing coalition in Finland of several left-wing parties. And, you know, of course, they had a civil war in Finland in the 30s between the left and the right. But they've still managed to come up with what is a very effective political system at the end of it.
OK, so in the US, what do you think? How long is this going to go on for, this legal battle, and who's going to win? At least there is we've got roughly nearly 3 months before the actual new president takes up their job. So do you think how much of that 3 months is going to be taken up in the courts?
I think that it's possible that in the next 24 hours, Biden will get enough Electoral College votes that even if there are challenges, that will decide it. It may not be the case. It may be that there will be the possibility of legal challenges, but several legal challenges have already been struck down. Because Trump has seems to have bet the farm on the idea that postal votes can be what they did in lots of states was they refused to allow postal votes to be counted before the election, so that they're all sitting there waiting to be counted. They could have been counted, but the Republicans that were running the various states said, no, we're not going to count those until the evening of the election. And then what they do is they count all of the in-person votes, which were more likely to be for Trump. And then they move on to the postal votes. And of course, what Trump is claiming is that after an hour or 2 hours or 2 days, the postal votes, he's won already. These postal votes are being rigged and all the rest of it. But the reason they haven't counted the postal votes is because of legal challenges by the Republicans to prevent them being counted. So you can see there's going to be lots of. And also, of course, the Republicans want to suppress turnout. They've always wanted to suppress turnout. They try and get as low a turnout as possible because they think that benefits them. So the more votes, if you remember back to the Hanging Chads fiasco in Florida back in 2000, that basically what happened was that they used legal powers to stop the recount, which therefore gave the Florida to Bush, which therefore gave him the election, even though he got less votes.
I mean, surely, really, this is a bit like the war on terror or the pandemic. It's a load of hoo-ha, really, because it doesn't really make much difference who wins.
Well, I think that's probably, you see, that's after all of this smoke and fire and all the rest of it, it actually means that the deep state in the US is still going to carry on doing what it wants to do. Biden's flagged up that he's going to recognize Israeli sovereignty over the Golan Heights, for example. So there's no change there. He's not going to assassinate Soleimani because Soleimani's already dead. He's not going to withdraw from Syria. He's flagged that up. And basically, he is a centrist, inverted commas, which means he's going to do everything that the Pentagon and the CIA want him to do. So that's why they're relaxed about losing Trump.
I mean, it sounds to me like he's going to be a bit of a Tony Blair, and maybe we've got another war on our hands.
A bit of a Tony Blair, because Tony Blair was kind of young and go-getting. Biden's
a centrist, Martin. I think you know what I mean. I'm not saying he's the same age as Tony Blair. He's the same, coming from the same political camp.
Yeah, I think if he wins, all eyes will be on Kamala Harris, because she will be the VP and she will effectively run the government. So she'll be the first black woman president, quite likely. We shall have to, but I mean, I don't, I mean, she's basically hopeless from a progressive point of view. I mean, what's happened here is that Bernie Sanders' left have been marginalized completely in the US, similarly to the left in the Labour Party here. And, you know,
and Tulsi Gabbard as well, story. Another really good candidate for the Democrat side.
Well, what would be really good from my point of view would be somebody like Tulsi Gabbard. But it's virtually impossible to get into the system. This is a problem, isn't it? If you try and work within the system, you're either completely sidelined like she is, or you get there, but you're completely compromised. And we need to change the electoral system. And, you know, the Supreme Court, for example, was never part of the initial constitution.
But
it sits there. It's going to sit there and sabotage any kind of progressive legislation going forward for decades to come.
What's going to happen now, do you think, well, into next year, once a new president is almost certainly Biden is sitting in the White House? I mean, basically, Kamala Harris is surely going to be running the show. I mean, this guy is basically, you know, he's on the edge of senility. He can't hardly string a word together, two words together. He's this kind of almost like this rigid figure with only his bottom lip moving when he speaks. You know, he's a very bizarre kind of character to have as the most powerful job in the world.
Yeah, but I mean, if you think about Ronald Reagan and George W. Bush, the president doesn't have to do much once they're there, as long as they've got other people who can do it for them. But I think the real problem is going to be Kamala Harris is actually quite conservative in many ways. She's not going to do anything to change the fundamentals of power in terms of things like regulating Wall Street. And she's the Supreme Court and all of the justices that Trump has managed to put in place. The Senate is going to remain under Republican control unless there's a very, very lucky break in Georgia. And that, you know, there's plenty of
Let's talk about Kamala Harris for a minute. Kamala Harris is a bit of a Keir Starmer figure. I mean, she was the state prosecutor in California, and she had a record there of quashing all sorts of very important, including child abuse cases, so they never ever came to court. At Starmer, as you know, in the UK, he was involved in the making sure the Assange case was prosecuted. He was also the person who stopped Surrey Police's two attempted prosecutions of Jimmy Savile when Jimmy Savile was still alive. So the idea of getting a state prosecutor who is easily pliable and then sticking them in straight into politics seems to be being copied over in the US as it's been working for the oligarchy in Britain.
Yeah, I obviously... Kamala Harris is a black woman and Starmer isn't, but they are very much this establishment friendly progressive politicians, so to the extent where, you know, you've got a big question mark over how progressive are they. And don't forget that the US system will give plenty of scope to the Supreme Court
whose agendas are they progressing? That's the point.
Well, they're basically in the pocket of Wall Street. I mean, that's the whole point. I mean, this is why the rigging of the primaries is so important. Yeah, because if you rig the primaries, you can make sure that you've got two candidates on the ballot who are acceptable to Wall Street. And that's because you've got an official party structure. I mean, in other countries in the world, you can form different political parties. I mean, you know, Farage is now going to change the name of his party to the Reform Party. And he doesn't have to discuss it with anybody. He can just set up a party and off he goes. You know, he won't do anything very much under first past the post.
OK, so the American
he's going to peel off conservative votes, he hopes.
Finally, on the elections, the major American TV networks, according to the Telegraph, well, you could hear them, cut off Donald Trump's mid-speech when what they call were baseless claims of election fraud. Well, again, you see, it's interesting to see them using this idea of baseless claims. Well, you know, he and his legal team are saying that they're going to take this to court.
Well, there's no mechanism for him to do so. I mean, he says he's going to take it to the Supreme Court, but how's he going to take it to the Supreme Court? You've got to have cases to take to court, and they've got to be cases that, I mean, they've already been thrown out. I mean, they've tried to stop the vote in various states around the country, and the local courts there have said, no, we're counting every vote. And he's saying, well, yes, but we're going to object. You can't object. These aren't valid votes.
He's immediately being called a conspiracy theorist. You know, say Trump, the conspiracy theorist speech. So it almost tells you that maybe there's something to it, because this is a term that they use to try and, you know, make mean, well, you know, don't even look at this because the guy's a nutcase. Well, he's not. He's a candidate in the US election.
Yes, and he's allowed to say whatever he likes, but then don't forget that the media are allowed to do whatever they want with what he said. They're not obliged to report it if they object to it or on whatever grounds. What people are saying, and I think this is definitely the case, is that he's preparing the ground for his people to refuse to accept the result, even though it's quite clear that they've lost the popular vote. He'll say we should have won the Electoral College because we didn't win in such and such a place, but you've lost the popular vote anyway. But of course, he's getting his people fired up to believe that even if they've lost, that they should have won, and that they're the real Americans. And
now, Martin, a few weeks ago, we even talked about a possible civil war in the States. We've seen pictures of gun-toting American Trump supporters hanging around the ballot boxes. Well, not actually the boxes, but at the voting booths outside the state capitals. Is that really a possibility here?
Well, not in the short run, but I think over the longer term, it's definitely a possibility. I mean, if you think about it, the US was virtually at civil war in the 1960s. Assassination of Martin Luther King by the government. I mean, we know he was assassinated by the government. There's been a court case which proved that. There's a massive cognitive dissonance in the US where there's been a court case, a civil court case, admittedly, which basically concluded that the government had assassinated Martin Luther King. And there was massive rioting after that, and hundreds of people were killed. And but at the same time, you've got a Martin Luther King holiday at the same time as a country that nobody's ever been held responsible for assassinating him. I mean, civil war has always been just beneath the surface in the US, always.
I'd just like to illustrate, you know, why I'm annoyed as a journalist to see the BBC saying lies, lies, lies. I mean, for example, Trump tweeted that in Ohio, 50,000 ballot papers were wrong. He says fraudulent. Actually, if you go and have a look, you'll find about 50,000 voters did receive wrong ballot papers in the post. So some of them didn't have time to actually vote. But there's no evidence that this was deliberate. Well, you know, he can say that that's done wrong and it might actually be proved to have been a fraud. Who knows? The local election board there says everyone affected has been now got the right voting, had been got the right voting slips, and they admitted that it was a serious mistake. So in New York, also 100,000 ballots had to be resent at the last minute to voters after names and addresses were printed incorrectly, this sort of thing. So it does seem as if there may be a little bit of truth to what Trump is saying, but that it's very unlikely that he's going to win because, you know, that's just the way it goes. Surely, you know, this is just Trump is going to have to suck this up, just as, for example, Hillary Clinton had to last time with lots of her potential voters standing in line and not being able to vote, Martin.
Yeah, I think that Trump is going to have to suck it up is absolutely the case. But he's also preparing his base to be very, very resentful about it. Now, he can do that if he wants, but then he's escalating the situation and he's creating the possibility of further conflict further down the line. He probably doesn't care about that. I'm certain he doesn't. But, you know, the situation is pretty dire in the United States. There's going to be probably a further stock market crash. The Wall Street are pretty happy about Biden. They know he's no threat to them, so they're not panicking about him becoming president. But the underlying the whole thing is that it's all built on sand anyway. And when it crashes, and don't forget the economy, the real economy is already in the tank. And, you know, when you get mass unemployment in the United States, along with the social divisions between the haves and the have-nots and the racial tensions that there are, and everybody armed to the teeth, unlike, say, Belfast in 1969, everybody's got a gun. And, you know, you can see where it could easily end up, just like in Colombia.
Well, yes, let's hope not. Anyway, let's move on to look at some much more local stories. particularly here in Bristol, Martin. A Bristol MP has been demanding that the government restarts the Everyone In for homeless people during the original coronavirus lockdown in this new lockdown. So I guess this is, you know, this whole situation is if you're going to have another lockdown, you're not going to really want to have lots of you know, homeless people out and about, sleeping on the streets, etc. This is Bristol West MP Thangam Debonair calling on the government to issue clear instructions that everyone should be brought off the streets as part of the new month-long lockdown from through most of November.
Well, she's the housing spokesperson for the Labour Party, I believe, these days. And obviously she's the MP here in Bristol West. And, you know, there's massive street homelessness problem in Bristol. For people outside Bristol, it's, you know, you can't get away from it, and it's perfectly straightforward what she's asking for, isn't it? And don't forget that the weather is going to be absolutely atrocious going forward, so if we're prepared to get people off the streets in March, well, surely we should be able to get them off, and we should get them off the streets in December and January.
Well, I mean, I've just been getting information that Picton Lane in Montpellier on Monday morning at 6 a.m. there's going to be a common law eviction of people. So I don't see Thangam speaking out about that. I mean, this seems to be a bit hypocritical to have a housing spokesperson, Thangam Debonair, talking about we've got to house the homeless whilst not doing anything about people in our own constituency who are actually being evicted during the second lockdown. Not only that, I mean, there's this injunction case that's going trundling its way through the Civil Justice Centre, the county court, where Marvin Rees and the council are trying to get an injunction to take people's vehicles away and possibly leading to 2 years in prison for anybody found living in a vehicle in the part of St Werburgh's around the tunnel and around the farm pub and the city farm there. So there seems to be nice words about this, but actually the actions are very much against travellers, people living in vehicles and people like this. They're being turfed out onto the streets whilst Thangam is saying she thinks this is a terrible thing and it must be stopped. So, you know, there does seem to be a bit of a disconnect between what the spokespeople for the Labour Party are saying and what the Mayor Marvin Rees is actually doing.
Well, I mean, you picked up a contradiction there, but there's a third factor that you haven't mentioned, which is that lots of people in rented accommodation are not going to be able to pay the rent. And up to now, there's been a moratorium on evictions, but that needs to be extended as well going forward. What's beginning to become clear, I think, as we go into 2021, is that we're basically going to be in a very extreme economic situation, which will require the government to spend money massive amounts of money to do all sorts of stuff, which they hadn't even thought of doing, but of course they should have done years ago.
Well, this eviction that's going to be...
Lots of people are going to have huge problems with housing.
Well, certainly in Picton Lane they will be next Monday morning. The people doing the eviction are supposed to be the Graham Rose Consultants, GRC bailiffs. I wrote an article about them a couple of years ago called Bailiffs in Balaclavas, alongside another journalist who was working at the Bristol Cable, but they refused to publish it, really explaining that these people are acting outside the law in many ways, and it's only because they know that the people that they're evicting have very little, no access to legal aid anymore, that they're able to survive as a business. Also, the professional bailiffs see people like GRC as a particularly pernicious lot, because they will say, well, we can do a cut price eviction, you don't have to go to court, and it's only half the price of what going through the court costs.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm not quite sure who's being evicted here. Is it a squat? What is it?
I believe it's it's a traveller site or people in caravans, that sort of thing, on Picton Lane. But, you know, this whole point of actually looking after homeless people during a pandemic seems to be out the window, mainly because it's not been scrutinised or looked at by the press. And I think that if Thangam Debonair was put on the spot on Question Time or something, that she would have to say, well, I don't agree with this. But the thing is, she's not being put on the spot, and so the hypocrisy isn't really being talked about much.
Well, I mean, we're talking about it now, obviously. I think don't forget, she's obviously the MP for Bristol West, but she's also the Labour Party's housing spokesperson.
Yeah, and I mean, there's lots of people, Martin, aren't there, that have been forced, basically, because of high rents and lack of income of all sorts, to either maybe live in a boat in the harbour or a barge or something, or find a caravan or a vehicle to live in, because they simply cannot afford these private rents.
Yeah, but I mean, you'd have to, we need more specific information. Are the Picton Street people being evicted? Who's evicting them? Yeah, is it the landowners? Who is it? Who's doing it?
I would imagine it's the people that own the land, probably.
Well, in other words, it's not directly the responsibility of the council anyway. You see what I mean?
The injunction which the council are paying for a top barrister to get in St Werburgh's will mean people may lose their vehicles completely, their home completely, and also, and this is right on Fangham Debonair's.
Well, in St Werburgh's, we know that it is the council which is the protagonist. But I don't know enough about what's happening in Picton Street to know
Anyway, look, all I'm saying, Martin, is I would have thought that any housing spokesperson worth their salt should be speaking out against illegal evictions taking place during a lockdown. But let's just move over to look at Bedminster for a minute, in the south of Bristol, where a lot of the traditional Bristolians, live. I can always remember going to the bakers there and being told, what kind of bread do you want, my lover? And being slightly shocked one of the first days I was in Bristol back in the 1990s, being called my lover. That's what the kind of way they speak round there. But in Bedminster, there's just been an enormous planning decision, which is having a massive impact on them. Bedminster Green, for many years, the developers have been trying to get planning permission, speculators, for big tower blocks right next to small two-storey terraced and semi-detached houses in the streets, mostly terraced streets. Can you say something, Martin, about this? Because in traditional town planning circles, this is just not done. You don't build a tower block next to a street of two-storey terraced houses, mainly because it looks ugly, but also, of course, because it blots out the light from all these little tiny houses. But it looks absolutely appalling. But there's a big temptation to do this, isn't there? Because you can cram a lot more people into the footprint of a tower block.
Well, I mean, I don't know enough about this to make a very informed comment, but the planning system is geared in favour of the developers. It just is. And it's very difficult for local authorities, even if they had the will, to resist the developers, because the developers, at the end of the day, have the whip hand.
Well, they have resisted them up until now. In fact, just on going through the legal constraints against these big developments, and they've managed to, the council, along with WAM, which is the Windmill Hill Local Planning Action Group, and I spoke this week to Nick Townsend from WAM. He's the chairman of the local planning group around there. What he's explained to me is that there's been quite a big change since the mayor, Labour mayor Marvin Rees, took over, in that all of these objections have slowly been worn down by the council. The council is now on the side of the speculators rather than the local people. And what he describes here is one of his first meetings with the mayor, Marvin Rees, who didn't really seem to recognise that WAM is a formal part of the council consultation process when it comes to planning. So let's have a listen to Nick Townsend, the chair of WAM now, speaking to me yesterday.
In the actual consultation of the plan of the Bedminster framework, we had no say. And then it was just agreed by the council, so who are presumably were desperate to, adopted by the council, who were desperate to build houses. So we didn't feel, I don't think local people felt that they were involved in this at all. We actually developed our own community brief early on, little document, and we met Marvin Rees. It must have been 2015 or something. And we thought that he'd been elected on the promise of wanting to work with local groups. But I have to say we found him not very forthcoming, and he was very suspicious of us, and he took the community brief, but we didn't hear from him again. So,
well, hang on. I mean, the mayor is suspicious of local people. Why?
Well, he just backed out of the room. He thought, he said that, I don't know basically who you people are. I want to hear from other groups in the area. So he wasn't welcoming at all. I must say he was pretty charmless, to be honest. And we didn't feel very well received by him at all. And he never, ever got back to us. So I think we were correct in our assumption. There were eight of us there. We all went up on an afternoon. People took time off work, and I think people felt it was mainly a bit of a waste of time, really. I'd feel embarrassed because I voted for him myself, but it was only after he was elected that he came out and spoke about his approval for building up. He hadn't said that before. I would never have voted for him. So, throughout this 5 years, unmistakably, we felt that the council, we've never felt confident that we've been listened to by the council, and that some deals have gone on with, we know that some deals have gone on with the developers.
Deals with the developers, I suppose, Martin, maybe the council just simply wants to build as many houses as it possibly can, because it knows it's getting income from each and every one as part of what used to be the rates, what's now the council tax.
Yeah, well, I mean, the council taxes, it's not so much that. I think they want to reach their targets for houses built, boxes ticked, etc. The allegation being made here, or implied, is that Marvin Rees is in the pocket of the developers. Now, I'm not going to comment on that because I don't know enough about it to say one way or the other. But of course, what he would say is we can't really stop these developments even if we wanted to, because all that will happen is they will appeal and then they will win. So we might as well, if you can't beat them, join them. And of course, then therefore he's been quite keen to get, things through and to help developers, because he wants basically to be seen to be developing, doing stuff, which is, which will help, which in his mind will help his re-election next May. But I don't want to comment too much about it, because I just don't know enough about the detail of the development. So it'd be silly for me to say I know what's going on here, because I don't.
Well, it's 300 or so new homes, currently industrial buildings in Little Paradise on the north side of Malago Road, four tower blocks, four nine stories with other blocks of 13, 14 and 16 stories. Well, originally the local plan around there was calling for three and four stories, but now we're talking about, what's that, four times that height. That was, the situation before Marvin Rees came along. But he's obviously decided that these are good for the city. I find it a little bit of a shame, though, that the local planning group have put together their plan and then they're being told that, who are you? That I'm going to go and find another group that I think represents my views better. But they're the local people. They're the local group, and they have to live with these developments. But there is an enormous amount of pressure, isn't there, from these speculators? And really, the only person who can push back against it in Bristol is the mayor himself.
Yeah, and I guess I get from various sources that Marvin is quite relaxed about building upwards, whereas, of course, there's quite a lot of hostility towards that, certainly from architects like the previous mayor, and so on. But to be honest with you, I mean, you've got an elected mayor. This was a system brought in from the US by the Tories. And basically, the elected mayors have to go out and do stuff to be re-elected. And it all revolves around them. And of course, if they, there isn't actually any comeback other than the election next May
to do anything. You know,
yes, this, you're right. I mean, it does seem
this is all there is.
It's not a lot you can do if there's a mayor who seems to be representing the property speculators rather than the local people. I mean, certainly, you know, when he turns up to a meeting, the locals say, you know, that he's treating them with suspicion straight away, like, who are you? Well, they may well say, who are you? You know, you've just been elected mayor. WHAM have been campaigning in this area for the last 20 years or so in order to try and make sure that any developments are fitting with the local area. But look, why don't we just move on a bit now to talk about the pandemic. And I think one of the big, obviously the big change this week has been this second lockdown for allegedly 4 weeks. I'm not sure quite whether it really will be or not, but there've been some interesting developments over the pressure on the government on care homes. And there was a fascinating piece on this morning on ITV yesterday with a woman who actually was arrested and her daughter who wasn't and was filming it. And I'll put a link up to the film and to the This Morning interview on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. And she was arrested for taking her mum out of a care home on this morning. She was interviewed about it. So this is quite long. It's nearly 15 minutes, but it really takes you through what is actually one of the most, I think, important aspects of this entire lockdown phenomenon, the reaction to the pandemic. And even when we weren't locked down, people are being prevented from seeing their loved ones. And actually, there are more people now dying of who have dementia because they are being completely isolated from love. And that is one of the things that, you know, you basically, even if you have dementia, you often still recognize the loving care and affection of your family. That is now being deprived for many, many months for many of these elderly people. And they're just being psychologically crushed by this. So let's have a listen now to the ladies on This Morning who were arrested whilst taking their grandmother and mother, in her 90s from a care home, and they describe the situation and the circumstances around it.
Just 12 hours before the start of today's new lockdown, the government bowed to pressure and reversed a ban on visiting residents in care homes.
But with strict guidelines on how visits should be conducted, including floor-to-ceiling screens and COVID-secure visitor pods, many have criticised the measures for being overly restrictive.
Well, amongst those with concerns are Eilenia Angeli, who was filmed being arrested after she tried to take her 97-year-old mother out of her care home.
Eilenia and her daughter Leandra Ashton are with us now alongside Alice Beer, and hopefully in a moment the Minister for Care, Helen Whateley, will be here. Eilenia and Leandra, I wanted to start with you first. I just wanted to find out a bit of the background that led up to that moment, because Eilenia, you weren't planning on taking your mum, were you, at all? It was kind of, you just felt compelled to do it.
No, it wasn't planned at all. We were going for a window visit. I saw my mother through the window. It broke my heart. I just wanted to hold her. I just wanted to tell her I loved her. I was being prevented. I did request that she was taken outside in the courtyard so she could at least see us properly. All requests were denied, and it was just the way I was spoken to by the member of staff. I could not bear it for 1 minute longer. I had a bunch of yellow roses that I was going to give to my mother. I requested that they be given to her, and the door was opened slightly. And I literally pushed my way in, put my arms around my mother for the first time in 9 months. We cried. She kissed me. And members of staff saying, "I'm going to call the police. I'm going to call the police." It was dreadful. I am speaking for every single person who is in the same position as us, that we cannot touch, we cannot see our loved ones, and they are deteriorating in front of our eyes.
And I think this is the point that we really want to raise, is that we are not alone in this. There are thousands of families in the same position as us. And these rules that are in place in order to protect and to save need to be fundamentally challenged by us all, because quite simply, they're not. The number one death still in the UK is from Alzheimer's. The second is heart disease. Yet we are still focusing on one disease, as dreadful as that may be, we need to start broadening this discussion and looking at health, real health, because this is having an impact on every aspect of life and well-being. And this whole focus of staying safe and saving lives, this isn't anymore about staying safe and saving lives. This is about having a life. And those people in care homes are being denied a life.
You left the care home with Tina, with your granny, with your mum, and drove, both of you were in separate cars, and you stopped at the local garden centre and thought, right, to get your thoughts together, what have we just done here? How long was it before the police arrived?
Do you know what? We kind of lost track of time. We were so adrenalised. We just thought, my God, now we seem to be on the run with my nan. I mean, we talked about caring for her from home from the very beginning of lockdown, and it was something we wanted to do. But just this opportunity literally presented itself very spontaneously. The police arrived, I'd say, maybe about half an hour later. Obviously, they had our car registration number plates, so they found us.
The government are saying that they're doing this U-turn. We've heard about this U-turn, that they sort of bowed to this pressure. And before, we'd spoken about how families of care home residents could get this key worker status and they could be tested regularly to make a difference. So we felt things were moving in the right direction, but clearly not if you felt driven to such drastic measures.
No, it's actually getting worse. I mean, I know what the government is saying, but in reality, it's not happening. Different care home managers have different policies, and they're allowed to more or less do what they like. It's not governed, it's not central government.
And also, even from the beginning of lockdown, there have been certain care homes that have allowed relatives in. Yeah. So these are guidelines. It's not law. Yeah. So there are care homes. So at the beginning of lockdown, my mum, a nurse, said, I'll volunteer for free. I'll do anything. I'll work in the kitchen. That was denied, point blank. I think the real virus that we have here is fear. People are so scared of everything now that we've lost the ability to think creatively and find creative solutions.
Just talk us through the arrest process.
It's a sad reflection, isn't it, when I think the police, who were really very sympathetic for our case, and one of the police officers also had experienced a very similar thing to us. His mother had been in the care home.
Okay, well, I've got a statement here from the Humberside Police. Assistant Chief Constable Chris Noble said the care home had reported that a woman who they were legally responsible for had been taken from the home by her daughter. The 73-year-old lady was then immediately unrestrained, de-arrested and allowed to return home with her daughter. We understand that this is an emotional and difficult situation. Northgate Care Home refused to comment when we contacted them. Your mum was taken back to the care home. What is the situation?
My goodness, I mean, it wasn't good before. It's probably going to be it's going to be so much worse now. They say they're not taking calls. They just say no comment. It can only get worse.
Your mum's there and she's got even less contact with you now. And it's her, the one that you were worried about initially. And now things have got worse.
I do believe that because we had mum in the car, that they will now be isolating her. So I can quite see that they will say, she's COVID risk or something. And so she will be even more isolated. She'll be left in her bedroom, in her bed, I would imagine, for the whole period of the quarantine, which is going to be so detrimental for her.
I'm so sorry.
Well, we've got the minister on the line now, and it's Helen Whateley. So what do you say to that story? What do you think when you see those pictures? What have we become?
I find it really hard listening to that interview, and also from the conversations that I've had with family members and, in fact, residents as well during the course of this pandemic, about how hard it's been not to be able to visit as normal, or for some people, not getting to visit at all. And the stories are really genuinely heartbreaking.
So fix it.
Well, I mean, that's exactly today we're publishing new guidance on visiting for care homes. And the reason we're doing that is as we go into a national lockdown and we're asking people again to stay at home, actually, I don't want to see care homes go into lockdown again as they were.
We're in a lockdown. We're not going into one. We're in it today. The guidelines have only just been published. You haven't given any time for these care homes to be able to catch up and put anything in place. So all these families are just sitting there waiting and nothing's happening.
So the guidelines have been worked on with care homes over recent days and also weeks. And in fact, what we've done here is we are including in the guidance examples of things that care homes have been doing during the summer and autumn to enable visiting.
Yeah, but what about this particular care home then in that case? Do you encourage care homes to call the police if a family come to pick up their 97-year-old mother? That it's not necessarily about quantity of life, it's about quality of life. If you are 97 years old with dementia, then the chances of you leading a long life are unlikely. And so what's happening here is an elderly lady is being taken home to be cared for by a loving family. So do you agree that that care home was right to call the police?
I know how much people want to and need to be able to see that.
Should the care home have called the police?
Well, if you'll just let me just
Well, answer that question.
I actually can't comment on the individual actions taken by the care home or the individual actions of the police. I clearly don't have all the information about the situation, but I really want to see care homes find ways to enable visiting. That's what this guidance is for, to try and encourage all care homes to take the steps that I know many have already taken.
Will she be able to hug her mum for Christmas? Will we be able to hug our grannies for Christmas?
Well, let me just say, so what we're saying is for care homes, please do enable COVID secure visiting. And that's, for instance, whether it's in a sort of visiting pod or visiting area, but with a screen that goes floor to ceiling. We have to remember that COVID, unfortunately, does pass through the air and it's airborne. And so we are saying to people still to keep a social distance and to make sure that you don't get the transmission of the virus. So holding hands, hugging, I know how it feels. We're all of us, in fact, for those who aren't living in care homes, not able to hug and to have physical contact with somebody outside your house.
But where's the compassion here for a 97-year-old lady who is in her final years? The family want to hug her. They want to be with her. Damn the consequences. They want her. She needs them. You look cold. You look heartless. This is affecting people's mental health. There has to be a way around this.
Well, we've got parts of the country where 1 in 40 people are estimated to have COVID. So if you have a care home in an area like that with, say, 40 people living in it and 40 people coming in to visit them, the likelihood is one of those 40 people will be COVID positive but might not even know it, because we know that this is a disease which you can have no symptoms. Mm. And if somebody does take COVID into a care home, we know we have PPE, we know we have social distancing, we know we have these measures, but if somebody does take it in, it's still incredibly hard to stop that passing to...
Eilenia and Leandra wanted to ask you a question, and we've got you here, so this is your moment. What would you like to say, you two?
Currently, the Office of National Statistics, which I hope everyone who's watching will now go and take a look at, the number one death on the Office of National Statistics is from Alzheimer's. The second death is from heart disease. Now, interestingly, if you look, the five-year average for Alzheimer's is at the lowest it's ever been. Also, for every other illness, every other death that we would normally have a higher rate for, they are all down. However, COVID has appeared as this huge number. Now, let's just be clear that these lockdown measures that are taking place are based on incredibly dodgy data. And there are people in government that know this. So while there may be a virus that may be hurting a very small proportion of the population, these lies need to end and the discussion needs to broaden. We need to be talking about holistic health. We need to be putting as much money into a campaign to terrify people out of their wits. Everywhere I go, I see billboards talking about masks. Nowhere is there a discussion about how you can empower yourself in your health. It is disgusting.
So I know, as I said, how the visiting restrictions are affecting people. That is why we're putting out guidance to enable visiting. But we do this against a backdrop where really, really sadly, we've seen over 15,000 people living in care homes die from COVID. Indeed, many of those who also have dementia. And we know we have a virus that once it gets into a care home is hard to control. Also, the care workers working in care homes are put at risk when there is a COVID outbreak in their care home.
Let me just final word from the minister.
Well, what I want to do is to enable visiting. That's why we're having this conversation today. I want people to be able to visit their family in care homes. We have to do it. We're in a pandemic, in a way that protects people as best we can from catching COVID. I also want us to bring in testing to make visiting less risky as quickly as we possibly can. And we're going to be trialing that later this month to roll it then out in December so more people can visit.
Yeah, so you've had a bit of time to sort that out. Got to say, if you're rolling that out in a month, there's been quite a bit of time to get that together. We've been doing this for a very long time. But Minister, we appreciate your time this morning. Thank you very much indeed for talking to us.
So Alice, you've just listened to all of that and just wondering your thoughts, really, finally.
I think if that minister genuinely wants to move forward and enable visiting, they would do much more than print a piece of paper that says you can see a relative through a piece of plastic. They have not enabled care homes to let relatives in. That is not what they've done this morning. Those new guidelines are absolutely not worth the paper that they are written on. They do nothing for the 400,000 residents of care homes who are sitting there unable to spend the last 2 years of their lives, because that's the maximum you kind of get in a care home. That's the reality. People have not seen their relatives for 9 months, and it is absolutely woefully inadequate that our government is not doing more. Care homes will not allow relatives in because they're petrified of being sued. They're petrified of COVID because relatives are not being tested. The government needs to do more immediately. This is terrible. What Leandra did was break the law, because a care home has a power of attorney, so they had to call the police. So I do not condone what she did, but what the government needs to do is act absolutely now, straight away, and not issue just hopeless guidelines that don't help anybody.
Well, that's a pretty shocking indictment. Martin, what do you make of it?
Well, what's the final comment was that if people were tested before they went to care homes so that they were COVID-free, then they could go into the homes. You can see why, given the debacle that there was earlier in the year, they're very concerned to protect people in care homes. And don't forget that if we were to go for herd immunity, God forbid, care homes would have to be completely locked down and people wouldn't be able to visit them. So there's a bit of an inconsistency with the woman who's complaining there saying...
Yeah, unless they were tested.
Well, yes, I mean, I think that the solution to this is if she'd been pre-tested and was clearly clear of COVID, then she can go in and cuddle her mother.
Well, also,
and of course, this is what's been missing all along.
There. Is a proper testing. You know, COVID can run riot within care homes. Well, we know from our own experience, I mean, certainly my family, is that there have been COVID outbreaks, supposed, in care homes that I know of. And what happens is the staff are extremely good at isolating those people in a part of the care home, and so it doesn't spread.
Well, yes, but of course, one of the things is you don't want it coming in the first place if you can possibly avoid it.
It can come in, surely it can come in with the staff just as easily.
Well, yes, apart from some care homes, as you know, had their staff live in during the lockdown.
Well, very, very few. I think you'll probably find something like 0.01% or something.
Well, I mean, this is a problem with... I mean, this is, you know, there are no easy options here, are there? You can see why the government...
Well, the easy option
another
test, surely.
Surge in care homes is going to be extremely, you know, they don't want that.
The easy option, surely, is to take steps to prevent it.
They need to test. What we really need is a proper test and trace regime. I mean, we're in a second lockdown now, and what they need to do in the 4 weeks of this second lockdown is get this test and trace regime sorted out. Dido Harding should be sacked. I mean, Graham Brady, the senior Tory MP, has said, let's put a general in charge of it. It's a bit like the G4S mess up on the Olympic Games, where the army has to come in the end and do.
Yeah, the problem is with the test and trace is what we've got. This is a case demic going on with loads and loads of cases. And I'd like to have a listen now to Mike Yeadon. I mean, he's I think very, very interesting guy. He's one of the top epidemiologists, retired now from Pfizer, and he's been speaking a great deal about this recently. Unfortunately, he's been scared off from going on to mainstream TV to speak to Piers Corbyn this week, which is a bit of a shame. But he is actually been speaking about this topic. And I'm hoping that we've got a clip with him, although I can't actually see it on my list here. What I might do is just send it over to discuss that in a minute, because it's a very, very important thing he's saying. Oh, that's it. It's the Delling Polecast with Dr. Mike Yeadon. And here he is really taking us through this whole idea of a case-demic, the idea that you've got loads and loads of cases of people who are not ill and that we've never, ever had this before. Dr. Mike Yeadon is an absolute expert in all of this, and he explains that what's happened is as the actual number of people who are ill with COVID-19 has fallen down, so this obsession with testing everybody has led to an enormous number of people who are not ill with the disease and not infectious or anything, but are still getting positive results. And so there's a kind of paranoia, a mental illness which has formed around an obsession with testing on a test which doesn't actually tell you whether or not people are ill with COVID-19. So let's have a listen to Dr. Mike Yeadon now speaking this time last week on something called the Delling Polecast.
When you look at the long decaying curve, which went downwards for I think 12 or 14 weeks straight in terms of cases, hospitalizations, ITU and deaths, all beautifully curved down, not one single wiggle in it, despite we were told, you know, to not go to work for a while, and then we could go to work, then we had like Black Lives Matter process, we had full beaches at Bournemouth and stuff like that. So there were businesses reopened, pubs reopened, you know, come on. If these things had changed significantly, the rate at which the virus moved amongst the population, it must be the case that it would be reflected in the death curve. And it is not. And it is not anywhere. These curves are identical in all heavily infected European countries. Sweden, France, Spain, England, you know, or UK. They're all the same. And they went through the turning point at a similar time. And I'm just briefly going to describe something that's very important about that. And then they all decayed. And I think that's all correct. I don't think it was any funny business. I think those are pretty much correct. And the test, the PCR test, the swabbing, I think was being used appropriately in hospital to distinguish people who were ill with SARS-CoV-2 or COVID-19 versus something else, because they look rather similar most of the time. But I think something awful happened in the middle of the year. And there's something awful, and you'll remember this now, as the sort of test notion, as if testing more is good, and if we can test many more people, that's better. And so what happened is this PCR, polymerase chain reaction, swab test, so-called pillar two, was rolled out of the nasty rumble. And they started initially, you'll remember, it was like, I don't know, 10,000 a day, and Robert Peston and Laura Koonsberg would flagellate Hancock and the Prime Minister, why aren't you testing more people? And so they gradually increased the effort, and they were up to like 100,000 a day. Now, the little thing you should know about this is absolutely fundamental. It's not true that if you test more people, you'll save more lives. Once you start going out there with an industrial scale test in the population, what you'll find is the average percentage of people, you know, with the virus at that time was about, I don't know, 1 in 2,000. We know that from the ONS. ONS have done really good work. They're independent from the sort of Witte, Valence, Ferguson group. So the population as a whole didn't have viruses. There were still people coming into hospital, not that many, and the test was good in hospital. But if you use this test, turn the big guns on the population when only 1 in 1,000 have got it, then there's this concept called false positives, that a certain percentage of the tests will come up positive even if there's no virus in it. A friend of mine used to call it the Bud Light test. It'll be positive even if you put in the sample, you've got it Bud Light. And it's an unavoidable characteristic of all tests. And you need to know what does it do at the extremes, false positive, false negative, and so on. And I would have been fired in my first job if I was ever using a test and my supervisor asked me about this. And I said, you know what, I don't know and I can't be asked. I'm going to use it anyway. So that's what they've done. The government didn't publish these characteristics. And I remember getting more and more. I didn't have any feeling of something seriously wrong other than just carelessness at this point. And I was searching the literature for what the hell is the false positive data? And I couldn't find it. And that's eventually when I got to a government document by Kate Barker. And she wrote on June the 3rd this year to Sage, saying more or less, she didn't say this, so sorry if I've misused your words, Kate. She said more or less, for Christ's sake, don't use this test like this. because it's got an unknown false positive rate. And based on all the other tests like this, it'll be somewhere between like 1 and 2%. Now, you might not think that's a big deal, but she knew it was, and I know it was. So if you've got a false positive rate of 1%, then for every 1,000 people you test, 10 of them will come back positive, even though they don't have the virus. But if the prevalence is only 0.1%, like ONS said it was in the summer, only 1 in 1,000 are genuine, and they will be found positive. So I've just told you that out of 1,000 tests in the summer, 1 positive was genuine, 10 positives were false. In other words, over 90% of the positives were false. Now, some people have said to me, well, you know, that's not true. The testing was done in test centres, and you were told only to go if you've got symptoms. I mean, yeah, that's good. But we all know people who've been told to get a test by an employer or someone at school or college or whatever it was to say, well, you've been near someone that's later turned out to be positive. We don't want you back at work, Dave, until you've got a negative test. So it is my assertion that actually most people went to get tests in the community who didn't have symptoms. And if they did, they could have had one of 20 other viruses. It doesn't mean it was COVID-19. And finally, here's the killer that destroys the argument against me, that they were all symptomatic and so you're wrong about your stats. The killer flaw is, we've all seen this. I've seen, people have posted them. Councils are trying to be really helpful, and they will be leafleting their streets in Bolton and in Birmingham and Manchester saying, in order to help us understand where this damn virus is, we're going to swab the whole street or the whole district or the whole quarter. That's what they were doing. That's pillar two. And that's the only way you can test 500,000 or 300,000 people a day is if you marshal your forces and send your testing vans to an area, and then you go and leaflet or even just go house to house. So I am telling you that all through the summer, the prevalence of the virus was low. The false positive rate was unknown, but actually, as it turned out, 10 times higher than the genuine rate. And so most of the positives all summer long were false positives. And I can think of no reason, Sir Patrick, why you would think of doing this, knowing as you do, because you've the same training as me, that what I've said is true. Why would you do that? The only reason you'd do that is if you were interested in keeping people fearful. There was no other COVID-19 related stuff happening in the news. That there were still people dying, but it was falling and falling and falling and falling until it was actually like 10 a day, which may sound callous, but actually 1,700 people die a day in this country. It was effectively zero. I think actually they were false positive COVIDs anyway. So this test was rolled out and it's not stopped rolling. I think at the heart of what's going on is a failure of everybody initially to appreciate that when the virus is not very common, all tests have a false positive rate, and I think almost all the testing, and it gets worse, the more you amplify the testing to get more and more not ill people, the more likely you are to get false positives. And so we've got this a permanent sense of fear. We'll never escape COVID-19 if we keep testing, because most of the results are false.
That was Dr. Mike Yeadon. Martin, he's one of the top experts in the country. He published an article on Saturday, the same time as the knockdown was announced, on Saturday's Daily Mail as well, which I'll put up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Can you just explain what you think is wrong with what he's saying there? Because he's really saying, isn't he, that this massive obsession with tests is clinically and medically totally wrong. What we're finding is the more we test, the more false positives will come up. And he's saying that he reckons, and he's explained there very clearly, why he believes that the vast majority of these are false positives.
Well, I mean, he said, I'm, you know, it's difficult to argue with the professionals like that, but of course, other professionals will argue with him. But just picking up on it, he said there is a 1% or 2% false positive. Now, okay, that's clear, and there's obviously you know some people are going to falsely test positive, but how does that translate into the majority of people who test positive are false positives?
He said World
well,
War
can II. Maybe you weren't listening. Can I just explain?
Well, yeah, go. Perhaps you can explain
is
it.
That the vast majority of people being tested now have no symptoms and don't actually, he believes, have the illness. And so, and that's the PCR test is designed to detect whether somebody has got a viral infection or pneumonia or something else. And so you can then have an idea about how to treat them. It is not a, it doesn't mean if you're testing positive on the PCR test that you've actually got any kind of active COVID-19 in your body at all. And so all these people who are being tested who don't have symptoms, the vast majority now, they, as even if it's only 1% that come up as false positives, they are now in the majority because almost all the people being tested don't have any symptoms, don't have COVID-19. So that's basically what he explained there. And I don't think it's possible really to dispute that. And there are lots and lots of doctors. I mean, well, you're sort of saying, oh, there
but
are doctors.
I still don't understand what you're saying, Tony.
But it's now a massive organisation of doctors around the world. Tens of thousands of them, actually, who are disputing all these facts to do with the pandemic. And we're going to have a listen to some of them now. The doctors group is called the World Doctors Alliance, and they've now set up a sort of splinter group from that, who is called the World Freedom Alliance. Now, they're looking not just to talk on the media, they're now looking at setting up political parties so that when there's an election that people have got someone to vote for who understands some of these clinical issues and will stop the insane testing all the time of something which doesn't actually exist. So don't you think it's interesting that these doctors have taken that role on, Martin?
I think they're basically acting as politicians, Tony. And politicians have to justify their decisions politically. And let's hear what they've got to say.
Well, they're medical professionals.
The medical professions paid for by the government through our taxes are not saying this, are they? They called for a lockdown several weeks ago.
You would prefer the government for its own reasons, ideas of witty imbalance from the industry.
Sorry?
So you would go more with the ideas and you would trust more Chris Whitty and Valance from the industry who are on their revolving doors.
Well, he used to work for Pfizer. So he's from the industry, isn't he? What he's probably got is very conservative politics.
He's not in power as an advisor to the government making these decisions and explaining them on national TV.
No, he's not. And of course, what you'll find is what's happened in the vote this week in the House of Commons. If you look at the opinion polls, people do trust the government's advisors rather than these outliers who are, you know, making their case on the internet.
I would say the same on 9/11 is when the planes hit the towers. People initially trusted the government. They didn't think that they were being conned, that it was some sort of attack from Afghanistan. Anyway, let's have a listen to the World Freedom Alliance now. As they kind of set out their stall as a bunch of activist doctors who feel that they're going to have to actually get people to stand in political parties in order to make a difference, having basically been banging their head against a brick wall when it comes to a lot of the mainstream media and political parties in mostly in the developing world and Europe.
Welcome, everyone. My name is Professor Dolores Cahill, and it is my great honour to inform you that we have founded the World Freedom Alliance, and this aims and will be a worldwide organization linking groups in all continents of the world and in individual countries. And we want to unite under the charter of the importance of our freedoms, freedom of speech, for example, freedom of assembly, freedom of bodily integrity. And we are uniting groups across health and law and education so that we can empower you to understand what is going on, to try and solve it so that it never happens again, and to be involved in building the better world that we all want to live in.
My name is Heike Schöning. I'm a medical doctor from Germany. I'm the vice president of the World Freedom Alliance. Formerly, I was one of the founders of their extra-parliamentary inquiry committee on COVID-19. And in this umbrella organization, the World Freedom Alliance, it's our duty to provide evidence-based medicine and evidence on this issue, what is a worldwide threat, this COVID-19 hoax. So we look forward to work with you for a better normal, not a new normal, and not an old normal that created this situation of this new normal. We want to create with you a better normal. Thank you very much.
Hello, my name is Monica Helleberg. I'm the chairman of World Freedom Alliance, and I look forward to unite the networks of the world that work towards our protecting our freedoms and our rights. We are so many people standing up for the truth, and we need to really bring the truth to the people, and we need to unite to be strong together. And we want to create the new, to set the best examples and to spread that so we don't have to reinvent the wheel. And this is urgent, and this is why we're forming this alliance. And we're so happy to also welcome other people in the world that want to reach the same goals as us. So thank you.
Hello, my name is Martin Byrne. I'm a lawyer from Ireland and an advocate for human rights. I'm honoured to be in the position of legal advisor for the World Freedom Alliance. And my goal as part of my function here in the World Freedom Alliance is to aim to coordinate best legal practice across continents worldwide by liaising and networking with lawyers from all over the world in order to empower people, to help them to defend their fundamental rights and freedoms. In a recent Supreme Court case in Ireland, Mr. Justice O'Donnell mentioned the importance of constitutional or fundamental rights. And he said, "It should be remembered that the essence of constitutional rights is that they call for enforcement precisely when inconvenient. Contrary to the wishes of government, the clamour of the media, the public mood more generally, and even the personal wishes of judges themselves. Your constitutional rights have been given to you by your creator, and they cannot be taken away by government. Unfortunately, people around the world have been hoodwinked into believing that the government gives you your right to bodily integrity, your right to freedom of expression, your right to peaceful assembly, and so on. This could not be further from the truth, and we are here to help to defend and protect those very important fundamental rights and freedoms."
My name is Mats Palsvi. I'm a former investment banker from Credit Suisse and Morgan Stanley, and it's a great honor to have been elected treasurer of the World Freedom Alliance. My goal is to help facilitate and encourage people and political parties from all over the world to join political parties, to help find and start political parties that can sign up to the World Freedom Alliance Charter, including bodily integrity, my body, my choice, but also very importantly, I will encourage a banking reform. There was a quote said once by a man, "I don't care who governs as long as I control the money creation." So it's very, very important that the money creation must belong to the people and not private corporations.
Hello. I'm Fiona Hine, and I'm honoured to be the General Secretary of the World Freedom Alliance.
And I'd just like to finish off to say that our next meeting will be in Copenhagen on the 20th, 21st and 22nd. And we would like to have the eyes of the world on Copenhagen, especially for the rally on the 21st of November. And we are building a community of doctors, scientists, lawyers, and we want to expose the truth of what's going on and empower people about the importance of their freedoms, and that we elect our government to defend these freedoms. And once we understand that, we are also then building a better and wonderful world that we want to live in. So we will be having committees around politics to inspire political parties for elections in the future, so that we can elect governments whose fundamental role is to defend our freedoms, which are fundamental to our human happiness and the safety of our families. We will also have education committees and media committees, and we will be announcing on the 21st of November how we will have legal cases, for example, notice of liability, that we will implement these in one or two countries in the world, but we would love to have a snowball effect so that these legal initiatives can be used by you, because we know around the world there are people who want to do something to stop what's going on. So we want to provide legal information to have a snowball effect to hold individual doctors, coroners, politicians, prime ministers and presidents to account for what they have done. They have not defended our freedoms, and we are very proud to be here as the World Freedom Alliance to defend our freedom and yours. Welcome. We look forward to seeing you in Copenhagen at the rally on Saturday, the 21st of November, 2020. World Freedom Alliance.
Well, you could call it the World Freedom Alliance. You could also call it the Dolores Cahill Fan Club. But Martin, there was one comment. I mean, it'd be interesting to hear what you make of this. But the comment there about banking reform, just thrown in the mix with some Morgan Stanley guy who's their treasurer. What do you make of this group?
Well, I mean, obviously, I'm making of it what I'm hearing. I do know that these people are behaving. I'll just make one basic comment about it. If you want to influence politics as a doctor's alliance, if you like, let's call it that, then what you want to do is you want to be lobbying the existing power structure. You want to be saying to them, the Patrick Whitty's got it wrong. We think we've got it right. You basically make your arguments on medical grounds. Now, that was a political manifesto. And I would say, where is the World Freedom Alliance going to stand candidates? Are they going to stand candidates in Eastern? Are they going to stand candidates in Scotland? Are they going to stand candidates in South Africa? Because don't forget, in South Africa, you've got the African National Congress, you've got the Democratic Party, you've got all these existing political structures. What makes you think that you're going to come in as a bunch of doctors and just sweep aside the existing political structure in any country and that you are going to run the show? I mean, that just stands. I mean, I'm a political scientist, and that's just absurd. If you formed a political party in one country, say Ireland, you might be able to get somebody elected, but you'd still have to deal with the mainstream and the opposition, which, of course, in Ireland these days is Sinn Féin. So what makes you think that these doctors think that they've got a political agenda that's going to create a political movement all over the world?
So do you think they've shot themselves in the foot, really, by choosing the wrong tactics?
Well, I mean, it just doesn't make sense, does it? What my suspicion about all of these medical scientists who are objecting to the mainstream medical opinions is that they've got a political agenda, which they're using their medical qualifications to give a rhetorical background backup to their existing political opinions. Now, does freedom mean? A straightforward question to the World Freedom Alliance: do you accept that the 9/11 attack was carried out by the U.S. security forces? In that case, what do we do? Do we stand in elections? Do we try and get to prosecutions, or do we start making arms dumps and safe houses?
What do you make of these proposals on banking reform?
Well, I mean, it's interesting that you've got an ex-banker there. He says we've got to reform banking, but in actual fact, that's everybody knows that, don't they? I mean, it's not just reforming banking. We may have to actually take down the power structure that
isn't that what they're saying, that the power structure as it exists is not fit for purpose?
Well, I totally agree with that. But of course, the whole world is beginning to realise, as we move into this ongoing crisis, which isn't just to do with COVID, that everything is going to be challenged and everything's going to be up for grabs. The question is, people talk about the Great Reset. There's going to be a huge cataclysmic change. The question is, who's going to direct it? Who's going to be winners on the other side of it? And of course, it's actually to do with geopolitical struggles between the Chinese Communist Party and the Western capitalists, for example, and all the rest of it. And, lots of people are now starting to talk what's a very, very challenging language from even 5 years ago, because it's quite clear that we're not going back to where we were at the beginning of last year.
No, we're going to be talking about Hong Kong a little bit later. But look, I thought it also it's quite important, I think, to somehow to try and focus on specific individual experience in all this COVID. And there's this new thing that's come along called long COVID, which is where people get fatigue syndromes for months and months after having had COVID. The only trouble is, of course, this is something that's been around for many, many years, with chronic fatigue syndrome and ME, which many people have found it extremely difficult to even get the medical profession, their own GPs, to acknowledge that they've got. And I spoke to Jill Gardiner earlier this week, who's a fitness instructor who had ME, which has basically ruined her ability to be a fitness instructor. All she can kind of do now, really, is regular swimming, which, because her body is supported, the weight of her body is supported after having chronic fatigue syndrome. And she's one of those people who's really rather frustrated that she's saying that it suddenly her syndrome that she had is being rebranded as something to do with COVID. But anyway, let's have a listen to Jill Gardiner now, who is a long-term fitness instructor who has had ME for many years.
My name's Jill. I'm a mother of two grown-up children. I've been unwell with ME after contracting Lyme disease about 10 years ago. So I used to be a fitness instructor, so fitness was my career and a big part of you know, what I did. So the gym for me, exercise for me is a mechanism for helping me cope with my chronic illness. So being left with ME, it means I'm quite limited as to what I can do. So I use the outdoor pool and the sauna and so on to kind of help me manage my condition, really. Yeah, I've had a lot of conversations with other people with ME, and we are a little bit disgruntled, actually, because and the reason we're disgruntled is obviously it's not nice that people are suffering with a post-viral fatigue syndrome of some description, which is what a lot of people have when they are diagnosed with ME, is the fact that for decades a lot of people weren't diagnosed and were told it was all in their heads, and there's been very little research and very little compassion within medicine, because they can't offer you anything. I know a lot of people that have suffered with post-traumatic stress disorder because of the way they've been treated, and I know myself it took me 8 years to get a diagnosis, and then it took me 6 months to get awarded disability, and I had to go through quite a horrible process of being assessed. So it's very traumatic, and then to hear in the press and getting a lot of awareness around long COVID, it's a bit of a kick in the teeth, really, for a lot of us. It's almost a bit like, well, you know, we got diagnosed, we were sick at the wrong time, do you know?
We were sick at the wrong time, says Jill Gardiner. Martin, took her 8 years of trying to get diagnosed, and then 6 months to actually get a proper disability from it. And obviously that is not an easy thing to get at the moment.
No, well, I know various other people who've suffered from ME, and it was at one stage regarded as yuppie flu, and that people were malingering, or that the chronic fatigue syndrome is a major issue. And of course, as she said, you know, it may be that COVID also it looks like it may have been viral infections that caused ME in the first place, but it looks as if possible that COVID also causes chronic fatigue syndrome. So that it's therefore, you know, not something that you're just going to get once and it's just going to disappear and that's the end of it.
There's quite a few other sort of bits and pieces of COVID stories. There is apparently now an attempt to ban all protests as part of this second lockdown. The removal of the exemption for protests. So that apparently is going to make organising large-scale lawful protests almost impossible, Martin.
Yeah. Well, I think what happened the first time around was, in theory, they were banned, but as long as people were socially distanced, etc., then the rule of six came
in.
They
were explicitly not banned.
No, so
they're saying that we're not trying to stifle political dissent here, but now apparently they are.
Well, that is the way the thing is going, isn't it? You can see that there's been protests against lockdowns all across Europe in lots of other places, some of which have turned violent, for example, in Spain. The problem we're getting now is that although a majority of the population do support lockdowns, a significant minority do not,
and a minority of that minority actually see the whole lockdown process as a police state measure and so on. So we're not going to have the kind of consensual approach to tackling the problem that we had at the beginning of the year. And, you know, and there's going to be plenty of other things to divide people. We were talking about the US election earlier on. I mean, there's going to be plenty of things for people to get upset about, and they're going to get upset.
Look, David Icke has been banned from Twitter this week. He's been saying there is no virus for quite a long time, but finally his entire Twitter account has been closed permanently.
Well, as I've said before, Twitter or The Sun or the Daily Mail or the BCFM politics show are under no obligation to give anybody a platform. A BBC, who you mentioned earlier, using the word lies in relation to Donald Trump. Now, that's a debatable one because the BBC has a responsibility to be even-handed. But most media has no responsibility to be even-handed. Twitter hasn't got any. They shouldn't have the market power they've got. Ultimately, you could talk in terms of actually nationalising social media and then putting it under Ofcom rules. But as things stand at the moment, Twitter's opinion is as valid as anybody else's opinion. And if they don't want Icke on their platform, they just say you can't come on our platform. It's as simple as that, isn't it?
I'm very disappointed because, I mean, as I've said many times, I think David Icke basically discredits himself with much of what he says, and he should have the right to do that. You know, he's saying things like there is no virus, which, you know, quite clearly to me seems is complete and utter nonsense. Surely, you know, it's up to us to make our own minds up about what people say when they say things like that. You know, they're, like you say, this is a private business, but where are we going to get these dissenting voices if, social media companies are closing down things they don't agree with?
Well, that's an issue about whether social media, the social media companies have inordinate power. And of course, they're in cahoots with the deep state, as we all know. So they basically get rid of stuff they don't like in consultation with the deep state. So the idea that they're just private organisations isn't quite true. But on the other hand, if you're going to actually have, as it were, a public space, which is publicly run, then you've got to have you've got to have some rules about what people can and can't say. And of course, what's happening is that the government are treating what they regard as disinformation in relation to the pandemic as being therefore the sort of thing that they want to squeeze out because they want clear messaging and so on. Now, the fact is they can't squeeze out people. People are going to form their own views anyway. So in a sense, banning people doesn't achieve anything. And the other point is that, you've got to carry people on the basis of, you know, I'm basically in favour of freedom of speech. But you've got to realise if you're going to have freedom of speech, then people are going to say things you don't like. And that includes, David, you know, things that, you know, those who criticise the setup aren't going to like what, you know, we could say, well, basically, you people are troublemakers. You're causing all sorts of problems here. And we'll let you speak, but we're not going to take any notice of you because we don't agree with you. And of course, you know, how robust are the people want the debate to be? And I think we're going to have to get the ground rules right as we go forward.
Martin, what's going on is a very concerted attempt to control the narrative as happened straight after the September the 11th attacks. This is the way you're going to think, and we're not going to allow any dissent.
Well, what happens in every situation is that the various players involved try to control the narrative. Yeah, but you can't compare. You know, it's not, you're not comparing like with like, apples and oranges. The COVID pandemic.
Martin, I don't agree that, for example, you and I immediately after the September the 11th attacks wanted to control the narrative. We wanted to have a voice.
Yes, and we got our voice in various ways. But of course, the people behind the attack wanted to control the narrative. They took down loads of Muslim websites the day before the attack. Extraordinary, that, isn't it? The day before the attack, various Muslim websites well established in the US were taken down by the NSA. That in itself gives away what's going on here. But, you know, people like us arguing the toss on the internet are not the same as intelligence services trying to control a narrative. That's a different game.
Yeah, that's my point. Also, on freedom of speech, we had the sad death of Robert Fisk this week, the long-time Middle East journalist. He's a British guy. He spent a lot of his time working in Ireland. And just to read out a little bit from Jeremy Bowen's obituary on the BBC website, he said, "Journalism can be a dog-eat-dog trade. Fisk's colleagues were not always kind about his work. I'll miss Robert," he says, "his guts and his appetite for the fight, even though usually he followed a warm hello with some crack about the evils of television news or the BBC. Now, the irony here is that I heard Robert Fisk speaking a couple of years ago now on Irish RTE radio, where he was explaining the questioner asked him, he said, "Well, why do we never see you or hear you on the BBC?" "Oh," he said, "well, that's simple. About 10 years ago, they started insisting that I tell them what I was about to say on a live interview. And trying to run it through various points with me. What will you say about this? What will you say about that?" And he said, "Well, I'm not prepared to do that because I will say whatever comes into my mind at the time. I'm not going to have some sort of fake pre-prepared interview, live or pre-recorded with the BBC. I want to be able to say what I want." And from that time on, Robert Fisk, one of the greatest journalists in the English language, British born, was blacklisted at the BBC and they never used him again, Martin.
Yeah, well, I mean, he pretty much knew what he was trying to do there, didn't he? People like Pilger aren't on the BBC either. Fisky, I think, was pretty good about virtually everything he wrote, including being sceptical about the stories coming out of Syria, which were being spun not just by the BBC, but by the MI6 and the White Helmets propaganda arm, funded by our taxes. He didn't really go to town on that, but he was definitely sceptical about it. I remember reading in The Great War for Civilization, which is one of his, he was famous for writing great big thumping books. So he wrote this book, Pity the Nation, which is about the war in Lebanon, which I read years ago. And a lot of people rolled their eyes and said, "Pity the reader," because it was sort of 800 pages long. But I mean, the point is that he was very thorough. And in the book, The Great War for Civilization, he's flying in a plane in the US. And the stewardess comes up to him and says, "Are you Robert Fisk, the journalist?" He said, I am. He said, "Well, oh, the captain would like you to come into the cockpit so that he can show you how the 9/11 attack was carried out." So Fisk went to the cockpit. It's all in the book. And they said, "We'll just show you how the 9/11 attack was carried out. What you do is you punch in the coordinates of where you want the plane to fly, and then it just flies to the target, wherever it's going to go. It just flies directly there." And he said, "So that's how it happened." Now, of course, he was basically being played there, because in actual fact, the planes on 9/11 didn't fly directly to the targets. They flew around all over the place, which is something which has not been explained by the mainstream. But even Robert Fisk...
Well, there's also a lot of evidence, isn't there, that the planes were actually swapped, that there were different aircraft halfway around their zigzag routes, that the original planes with passengers landed and other planes took off with no passengers on that were remote-controlled.
That is definitely some of... I'm not going to comment on that too closely. But of course, what Robert Fisk had done is he'd interviewed Osama bin Laden 3 times. So he was basically, even though he was a great journalist, he was himself manipulated. He believed that he was, the guy to interview Osama bin Laden and all the rest of it. And therefore, he was also then, when he was on the plane in the US, the intelligence services in the US basically played him there. And he didn't look into it any further than that. And he presumed that that's what the explanation of what happened on 9/11 was. Now, everybody's got blind spots. You'll find that Pilger won't really want to talk about 9/11 either. I think he probably knows more than he lets on. But he basically knows that if he starts talking about it, then you get put in a box and you can't talk about anything else. And I think Fisk really, really hated the Western imperialist war machine. And, it's a shame that he's gone. I mean, one of the most useful things he did in recent times was to go to Douma, where all these people pontificate. He actually went there and talked to the locals, and the locals were telling him there was no chemical weapons attack. And he reported that. And, of course, lots of the people who are criticising him would never dare to go to Douma to talk to people.
Well, he was living in Beirut. I had some correspondence with him. I remember him going on about Bush and his Christianity, and the correspondence I had with him was a whole bunch of evidence. Well, basically, it was mainly pictures of George Bush Jr. in his little group of Skull and Bones. And he wrote back just basically a very short note saying, thanks, fascinating. So it's nice, you know, it's nice to actually think that there's a journalist out there who listens. I can tell you, people like Lindsay Hilsum, Channel 4 News, they simply do not listen. In fact, I got a very rude email off of her a few months ago because I'd sent her something which was, you know, quite important on foreign affairs. And she just said, you know, I don't want to ever receive anything from you again. And I hadn't been rude or anything, but there are a lot of journalists out there that simply do not want to listen. They just seem to want to, you know, they're accusing us of this whole sort of thing of confirmation bias. But actually, they're stuck in groupthink themselves, Martin.
Yeah, well, it's a danger for all of us, isn't it? I mean, if we're honest, it's a danger for all of us. And we all need to guard against confirmation bias in everything that we do, whoever we are.
One of Robert Fisk's final articles was having a pop at Boris on one of his speeches about the virus. Does Boris Johnson take the population for idiots? His latest offering suggests so. What the Prime Minister served up was full of flummery, cliche, pointless idiom and the inevitable whopper. So there you go. That's one way of saying they're lying without actually saying it's a lie.
Well, whopper implies that it is. Doesn't it? It's just a use of language, isn't it?
He says, if you want to transform your audience into children, then verbs can be a complication. It's a reaction. If it's reaction you want, not understanding. And I've always objected, he says, to subjected dictators. Now the populist leaders elected in our own democracies to a close analysis of the linguistic content of their speeches. And he goes on to do that. But look, we're going to hear a little tribute, staying on a kind of Irish theme, because he did a lot of his work in Ireland, Robert Fisk, with some music now in a moment from Van Morrison, one of his songs, which is against his latest song, which is called No More Lockdowns. But before that, just a final thing, Martin, I'll just get your reaction to this, because I think the star of the show for me at the moment is this guy, Dr. Mike Yeadon, who's claiming the majority of the population. He says the government's claims that the majority of the population susceptible to COVID is wrong. He's saying that only 7% so far have been infected is wrong. And also that the virus death rate at 1%, they're all wrong. And he explains why in the article. And I'll put that up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. And we'll be coming back to discuss more international matters. Not the US election, thank God, anymore, but more international matters after we hear from Van Morrison.
No more lockdown, no more government overreach. No more fascist bullies disturbing our peace. No more taking of our freedom and our God-given rights. Pretending it's for our safety when it's really to enslave. Who's running our country? Who's running our world? Examine it closely and watch it unfurl. No more lockdown, no more threats, no more Imperial College scientists making up crooked facts. No more lockdown, no more pulling the wool over our eyes. No more celebrities telling us what we're supposed to feel. No more status quo, put your shoulder to the wind. No more lockdown. Lockdown. No more lockdown. government overreach. No more fascist bullies disturbing our peace. No more taking our freedom and our God-given rights. Pretending it's for our safety when it's really to enslave. Who's running our country? Who's running our world? Examine it closely and watch it unfurl. No more lockdown, no more threats, no more imperial college scientists making up crooked facts. No more lockdown, no more pulling the wool over our eyes. No more celebrities telling us how we're supposed to feel. No more status quo, gotta put your shoulder to the wheel. No more lockdown, no more lockdown, no more lockdown.
So that's Van Morrison there. No More Lockdowns, the name of the song. From obviously from this year, from 2020, just released recently. But Martin, let's start on our adventures into the international world, avoiding the US, which we covered in the first part. Most importantly, I think this week, the terrorist attacks in Austria, but also kind of a bit forgotten, is Afghanistan. So four people now dead from the shootings in Vienna by ISIS, but also it's ISIS again that are behind the attack in Afghanistan. The attack in Afghanistan it was a bombing, the Kabul Education Center, an ISIS gunman. The Kabul Education Center was killed 24 people about a week, maybe 10 days ago. And then this week, an attack on Kabul University by an ISIS gunman has left 22 dead. So ISIS seems to be everywhere, Europe. And what is ISIS?
Well, the Taliban have condemned the attack on the university in Kabul, and they are not happy having ISIS in the country at all. And many of the ISIS militants inside Afghanistan were taken from Syria to Afghanistan by the Americans, according to the Iranians. What's happened in Vienna is, again, we need to look at it. But ISIS is essentially a front organization for the Saudis and the Western intelligence services. So we're still seeing the strategy of tension being played out, and they're played at one remove from the intelligence services. So ISIS can be used as the excuse for outside intervention in Syria. But at the same time, they are basically being manipulated by those same intelligence services. So there's lots of evidence from Syria and Iraq of ISIS militants, when they've been finally surrounded by the Syrian security forces or by the Iraqi security forces, being rescued and then removed to other parts of the world by US military helicopters. Now, you could say that sounds crazy. No, I don't believe any of that, Martin. But in actual fact, this is the statements by the Iraqi government have definitely claimed exactly that. And it's basically well known around the world that ISIS is a front organization for the Saudis and the Western intelligence services. So when they carry out attacks, it's because those people want those attacks to be carried out, and so that they can keep the, you know, strategy of tension going, and, you know, get everybody under the thumb, as it were. So, you know, on it goes.
Now, when we had on this show the investigative journalist from Eastern Europe, Diliana Katasheva, explaining, and, you know, in her own terms, with fully documented evidence, that ISIS was taking arms from the United States. Well, they weren't American arms. What they were was Eastern European built arms that were paid for by the United States, and they even had end user certificates that were the United States, but actually they were being shipped over by air to northern Syria for the use of ISIS and al-Nusra and these other groups. So this is actually cast iron proof and evidence that this is a covert operation by NATO and the United States in order to create a proxy army, which is basically a fake version of Islam, where basically these people are just mercenaries working for Washington.
Yes. And don't forget that, you know, they create these monsters and then they pretend to slay them. But if you go back to the 1980s, when the Islamic International Brigades first were gathered together to go and fight in Afghanistan, although they were supplied from Pakistan, the official story is, yes, we did indeed. You know, people can see the Hollywood film Charlie Wilson's War, which is all gung-ho about how fantastic it was that Senator Charlie Wilson had got millions and millions of dollars together to set up an Islamic international brigade to fight in Afghanistan, blah, blah, blah. And then on 9/11, basically after the bombings of the US embassy in Nairobi, suddenly this whole network that we've spent years creating and training, don't forget that some of these people were trained in Scotland by the SAS, etc. They've suddenly turned on us and now they're the enemy. But of course, the Syrian intelligence services, the Russian intelligence services, the Chinese intelligence services, the Iranian intelligence services are very well aware that all of these Salafist terrorists are directly or indirectly being run by the Western intelligence services. Now, that doesn't mean that you can't get people with mental health issues who kick off independently of that. That does happen as well, because the creation of a strategy of tension means that you've got lots and lots of flotsam and jetsam, young men in particular, who've got no outlooks in life. I mean, a lot of these terrorists that then end up being killed or whatever, they've had problems with drugs, drink, you know, totally un-Islamic lifestyles before they ended up doing what they're doing. And at one stage, the Saudis, for example, cleaned out their prisons of all their most serious offenders, you know, murderers, rapists, etc., and said, do you want to go and fight in Syria? Because if you do, here's your ticket. That's what's going on.
Now, the Islamic State has claimed credit, if you can call it credit, for the shooting spree in the city of Vienna in a statement released on Tuesday, according to Reuters and the site Intelligence Group, who they seem to be in touch with, which monitors online extremist content.
I was going to say, where is Rita Katz in all of this? And you've just told me where she is.
How do you mean?
Well, you said site Intelligence Group. That's her stuff, isn't it?
At least four people were killed and 14 others wounded, seven with life-threatening injuries in the attack. The gunman was later identified as 20-year-old Kujtim Fejzulay. And, of course, he is the only, apparently he's working on his own, although I heard at the time, I thought they thought there were multiple gunmen. He's now dead, so, of course, there won't be any trial.
Yeah, well, is it the case, from what you just said, Tony, that the ISIS claim of by ISIS that they did this came via the site network?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Yeah, so in other words, that is basically an intelligence, an Israeli intelligence front organization. And they're the ones who seem to get inside information on ISIS's claims about this and that and the other. Don't people start to smell a rat here? I mean, it could be a random person who's done this, and then ISIS claim it to make themselves look big, as if they've done, as if they're running everything. And there seems to be a general tendency for that to happen. But isn't it suspicious that the ISIS claim of responsibility comes via site, which is run by Rita Katz, who is an ex-Israeli intelligence officer? How come that she knows who ISIS are and that ISIS use? I mean, she is, that site has actually broken loads of stories about ISIS, because they seem to have inside knowledge about what ISIS is, what ISIS's strategies are, that they get the first of any of ISIS's press releases, whatever. But it's basically an Israeli intelligence front.
Yeah, but could it be the Israelis have infiltrated ISIS?
Well, that's what we've... I mean, what SITE stands for, isn't it? Can you remember? What does SITE stand for? I cannot remember now.
I'm not sure. Something intelligence entities or something.
Yes.
Intelligence entities, is it?
Yeah, it's something like that. So they claim that all of their stuff is simply through monitoring the internet. Although they get all these scoops about ISIS claiming responsibility for things. You'd have thought that ISIS would have their own mechanisms for getting stuff out there, wouldn't you?
Okay, so can I suggest another scenario for what happened in Vienna this week with these 17 people injured, four people dead? It's pretty simple. What you do is you get a kind of patsy fall guy, whether he's into it or not is almost immaterial, but you surround him with intelligence agents who are posing as militant Islamists, who are encouraging the fall guy basically to join them in a terrorist attack. He thinks that that's what they're going to do. And what happens is that they maybe do some of the killing, possibly, but he takes the rap, and then of course he's executed, and there's no way that he could say, well, I thought I was working with a terrorist cell.
Well, if you look at what's happened in the United States, virtually everybody who's been convicted of terrorism was basically entrapped by the FBI. So they went around finding people who've got drug, alcohol, personal relationship problems, tap them on the shoulder and say, hey, would you like to blow something up? Hey. And we'll even provide you with some explosives. And of course, the 1993 bombing in the World Trade Center, the explosives were provided by the FBI to the conspirators. Bit like the Gunpowder Plot. I've just been reading this book, The Gunpowder Plot Deceit by Martin R. Beardsley, a pen and sword book, basically how that was, the conspirators in that were all got together by Robert Cecil, who was the spy master for England at the time. And then, of course, it was all captured at the very last minute in those spectacular circumstances. They all died horrible deaths one way and another, and the Catholics were blamed, and the newly Protestant state of England became, basically more secure in terms of the population being bamboozled into believing that the Catholics had tried to blow up Parliament. And these things have been going on for a very long time, and the same kind of things are going on right now.
I wonder what you make of it in the modern era. In 1996 was a very important year in Israel with the assassination of the peacemaker Yitzhak Rabin. And then there was a general election in 1996 too, where there was a whole load of so-called suicide bombings going on in Israel. which brought Benjamin Netanyahu and his party to power. Basically, what he was saying was, look, you know, there's no point in making peace with these people. They're lunatics. And of course, it was proved true. And that's how Netanyahu won the election.
Well, Hamas was originally set up by Mossad. Sheikh Yassin was encouraged to do what he was doing as a way of undermining the PLO and the secular wing of the Palestinian movement. Now, that doesn't mean that modern Hamas is run by Mossad, because it doesn't work like that. You've got genuine political movements like the Irish Republican movement, for example, but they're heavily infiltrated. So we were talking last week about Scapitacci, steak knife, the head of the IRA's internal security operation, always working for the British Army. Now, the more you look into these things, the murkier it becomes. But you've got to recognise that you don't necessarily know everything that's going on, whoever you are, and that there's all sorts of potential explanations for any event.
I mean, it's just 25 years ago, this election, but it's now become clear that there's certainly a lot of evidence has come to light that possibly Netanyahu and his friends, who after all is from the Israeli Special Forces, were actually behind these bombings in Tel Aviv and Jerusalem themselves.
Well, don't forget that Hamas did claim responsibility for those bombings, as I remember. Don't forget that the Palestinians were dying every day, civilians being killed day in, day out, no restraint being shown. I mean, and in actual fact, you know, what did Hamas do there with bombing civilians inside Israel? There was anything different than the RAF pulverizing Dresden or the USAF?
But Martin, I would point out that there was really no point. I mean, I would point out that there's no point of Hamas starting a terror campaign at that point. There was a great deal of sympathy for the peace cause after the assassination of Rabin.
Well, we'd need to look more closely at this. But nevertheless, yes, it's quite possible that was the case. But don't forget that Hamas themselves never denied that they carried out the attacks. Now, that's because basically at that stage, they were trying to wrest control of the Palestinian movement from the PLO because the Intifada had basically failed. You know, we've lost loads of people here, many of them young people, and we've not managed to shift the Israelis at all. The only language they understand is blah. You know.
Well, as I understand it, that ISIS haven't denied these attacks in Afghanistan or Vienna either.
So they've claimed them. But then who is ISIS to claim them? What does it mean? And what I suspect is going on in Austria, that's probably just part of keeping the Austrians in line with the war on terror. In Afghanistan, it's to do with the idea that we don't want the Americans to be withdrawn here. The Americans are going to have to stay because of these terrible attacks. And otherwise, you know, I mean, that's exactly what they used ISIS as in Syria. So ISIS were encouraged. I mean, we know because General Flynn told us that they basically wanted to have an Islamic State set up, because that would then put pressure on Assad and also give them an excuse to intervene if they wanted to. And that's certainly the view inside the Iraqi government. And of course, the Saudis are in this up to their eyeballs, as they've always been. And the more you look at these things, the more manipulation you can find. And it's pretty clear what the pattern is.
Yeah, and there's also a pattern of suppressing journalism, just as our programme has been suppressed, even as a little tin pot community radio station in Bristol. There's a tremendous amount of it going on. Martin, let's just look at a couple of stories around the world before we go on to look at Hong Kong. But the Israeli officials are warning of war with Iran under Biden. The Likud officials are worried a Biden win will hurt Netanyahu.
Well, Biden is basically in the pocket of the Israelis. If you look at the statements by him and Kamala Harris, there's not a lot. You know, they're basically entirely acceptable. As they're acceptable to Wall Street, they're acceptable to the Israeli lobby. Nevertheless, what may happen is that the Israelis decide to go to war now with Iran, because Biden might decide that he doesn't like the idea. So if they want to do it, they've got to do it now. And that may explain the fighting in Nagorno-Karabakh, because the Israelis have been supporting the Azeris. And as a result of that, they've got access to Azeri airfields, which will allow them to carry out a direct attack on Iran. The Iranians
well, let's
are pretty
just
well aware.
Drill into this a bit, Martin. Israeli official warns of war with Iran if Biden returns to the nuclear deal. An Israeli official said if Joe Biden wins the US presidential election and returns to the 2015 Iran nuclear deal, it could lead to a war with between Iran and Israel. The settlement minister, Zaki Hanegbi, a member of the right-wing Likud party, made the comments on Wednesday night. Biden has said openly for a long time he will go back to the nuclear agreement. I see that as something which will lead to a confrontation between Israel and Iran. So he's basically threatening the Americans, isn't he? He's saying, if you want to go back to that deal, we're going to start a war.
Well, that's what he's saying. Whether that goes down very well in America, because they're planning for a war with China, for example. You can see what the tensions are here. Yeah.
Well, I don't know. How would that go down in Israel? It wouldn't necessarily be, you know, Israelis don't want a war.
Well, they keep electing people who say they do, Tony. I mean, there's hardly any peace camp inside Israel now, apart from the Palestinians who've got Israeli citizenship.
So do you think this means if Biden gets in that may be back, Americans might be back in the Iran nuclear agreement?
Well, what will happen? Let's just talk this through. If Biden is elected, and it just looks as we were saying earlier that he may be, he doesn't come to power until January next year. He has to be sworn in. And that's presuming that there are no legal challenges, as we were talking about earlier. For the if it looks to them, and Biden's flagged up that he is probably going to go back to the Iranian deal, then the right wing in Israel, if they want to go to war with Iran over this deal, are going to have to do it quicker. Because before once Biden becomes the president, he might be in a position, for example, to stop, intelligence support of such an attack. Trump will remain the president until January. So in other words, if it looks as if Biden, let's put it this way, if Biden wins in the next 24 hours, the Israelis may decide that is now the time to use the Azeri air bases and elsewhere to attack the Iranians with Trump support before Biden tells them no.
The apparently conflict in Ethiopia's Tigray escalates. Bombing is alleged, it says on antiwar.com. And Pompeo is siding with the Ethiopian Prime Minister in a statement. Not another little conflict erupting.
Well, there's been conflict in Ethiopia for a very long time. I mean, it's settled down in recent years, but it was always a conflict zone. Basically, there are lots of conflicts around the world, lots of little bushfires, and they're all the potential here for a big wind to come along and turn them all into one great big fire. Is definitely there, isn't it? No doubt about it. You'd have thought the whole COVID pandemic would have... I mean, at one stage, there was a United Nations resolution backed by the Russians and others that all sanctions should be suspended for the duration of the pandemic. And that basically, you know, while we were dealing with this, we'd put everything else on the back burner. But that's not what happened. There's definitely been an escalation of tensions. And we are getting closer and closer to the big one.
OK, so before we go to Hong Kong and to the chairman of the Hong Kong Journalists Association I spoke to yesterday, I thought we'd have a quick look at the Assange case and British justice more generally. And I spoke to Tim Wood, who's a former Murdoch journalist who worked as an Old Bailey reporter for many, many years. He's now retired and he does tours at the Old Bailey. So he even does sort of virtual during the pandemic lockdowns or whatever. You know, he's not been allowed to do that. So he's been doing these interesting online seminars too. Very active. And obviously he's decided in his retirement he's going to share some of the knowledge he gleaned over many years working on these top criminal cases. So here's Tim Wood talking about what he believes is a real serious crisis in British justice. And of course, that is reflected itself in the Assange case, which we'll hear from about in a minute. But he has obviously been into many of these courts and he speaks to many of the barristers and he nails the problems that we're having very firmly at the door of Kenneth Clark for withdrawing support for legal aid, because this has meant that many people just simply are going to get no legal support whatsoever. So anyway, let's have a listen to Tim Wood now, giving us his thoughts about the state of the British justice system.
If you talk to the barristers, especially the criminal barristers, You know, they are up in arms. Because of austerity, what's happened is the legal aid has been cut dramatically. And a lot of criminal barristers are claiming that they are actually earning as little as £5 an hour in certain instances. The reason for that is that the amount of evidence that comes into a case nowadays has grown dramatically, mainly because you've got CCTV, you've got mobile phone evidence, messaging, you've got, you know, where they can sort of pinpoint people where they were through triangulation of a mobile phone. And for the first time in the history of our justice system, the criminal barristers have actually gone on strike. They've been on strike three times, and there is uproar. The other problem is not just that, is that the buildings are falling apart. You know, because there's lack of money. I was talking to a barrister not so long ago, and he said, I think it was in a London Crown Court, which is sort of by the Elephant and Castle, and he was saying, you know, I tried to get down to the cells to see my client, but, you know, they're completely flooded and I couldn't get down there. And, you know, there's horror stories of sort of raw sewage running, you know, in, you know, on through on the ceilings and stuff. And there is real, you know, anger at how our criminal justice system has been sort of drained of money and neglect. And from the Rolls-Royce service that it used to be, you know, a lot of criminal barristers now are telling me, you know, it, standards are falling dramatically, and the only way to solve it is start, you know, paying, you know, and putting pumping money into the system, because, you know, it will fall apart. And because the criminal barristers are earning such little money, they're leaving the profession in droves. You know, you're talking about very able people, and they're going off to become legal executives in big business where they can earn four or five times as much as they can as a criminal barrister. And a lot of criminal barristers are almost doing it, you know, for love of the job nowadays, you know, and there is a real problem in our criminal justice system. And with COVID, and you're having this huge build-up of criminal cases, I mean, it's going to cause real problems in that justice won't be done, because you know, cases won't be heard for 3 or 4 years. And, you know, you're thinking of people's memories and witnesses being quizzed. I mean, you know, your memories fade, and, you know, it's, I don't know what they're going to do, because there is a big, big problem that was already there. But now with COVID on top, you know, it's going to cause, you know, our justice system to fall apart almost.
So that's Tim Wood, former journalist at the Old Bailey, who does tours. Well worth having a look at his website. Martin, it doesn't sound good, does it? I mean, he's saying it was already on its knees. COVID is really like almost like the last nail in the coffin.
Yeah, well, I mean, the cutbacks on legal aid, I mean, the legal profession have been complaining about that for a long time. I mean, we remember we had a barrister on the show some years ago talking about exactly this, and people say, well, what, you know, why do we need legal aid? It's because otherwise the wealthy buy the justice system, and lots of people who are poor haven't got any resources of their own, and if they get into trouble with the law, they need legal aid, otherwise they can't make a case.
Well, it's a big encouragement, isn't it, for the wealthy, or even as we were talking earlier on about the GRC common law bailiffs that go in mob-handed without going to court first. They know that the people that they're trying to evict or succeeding in evicting or dragging out have got no legal aid. They've got no access to justice.
That's right. And you know, it's already a pretty rigged setup, but it just tilts it even further in favour of the powerful and the well-heeled, doesn't it?
Yeah, so let's have a listen now to what Tim had to say about what he thought of the Assange case. And I have to say, I think he was quite pleased that I'd asked him about it, because obviously as a journalist, no longer writing for the newspapers and in retirement, he had quite a, you know, strong views on the way that the Assange case has gone.
what journalist wouldn't publish the information that he managed to get his hands on? I mean, it was a massive scoop. I think it's wrong that going to throw him to the Americans. And, if he does get extradited back, I don't think he'll be treated fairly over there. I think that, the hearing should never have happened. And I think he should have been, almost given asylum here, where he could sort of, live his life away from, the Americans who want to, put him on trial and maybe lock him up forever.
Tim Wood there with his website, Old Bailey Tours, just talking about Assange. Martin, in a way, there's a side of me that thinks that Assange shouldn't have just been given a medal for the brilliant reporting that he did, and publishing and investigative journalism that he did. He should also, be a newspaper editor himself. I mean, if you were to give him the editorship of, say, something like the Daily, one of these moribund, paper tabloids like the Mirror, you might find within weeks that they quadrupled their circulation, because people have an appetite for the sort of stuff that Assange was publishing. It's basically anti-establishment. It's exposing criminal activity that's going on in high places.
Well, I think Julian Assange himself wouldn't want to be a mainstream journalist. What he's done is he's pioneered the new form of investigative journalism, because as we know, Tony, the mainstream investigative journalism has virtually disappeared. I read Seymour Hersh's biography, Reporter, this time last year, and he said, well, you can't do what I used to do back in the 60s and 70s. Basically, I was paid good money by the New York Times and other big organisations to uncover government malfeasance, and I made a good living at it, and they sold loads of newspapers. You can't do that anymore. What happens, of course, is that they close down mechanisms by which such thing, you can do it once and then they close the they basically closed down that kind of journalism.
Well, yeah, so, but I mean, something like the Mirror, if they had a bit of an imaginative, but I suppose it says a lot of this is to do with the owners. At the moment, you pick up a copy of the Daily Mirror, it's nothing in it. I mean, but if someone like Assange was putting stuff in there, I don't know how long they might be victims of the courts, for goodness sake, for publishing the truth, yeah, which you're apparently not allowed to do anymore.
Well, part of the problem is, as you know, for a lot of investigative journalists, a lot of what they investigate never gets used by mainstream news organisations, not because it isn't true. It's just that they can't take the legal pressures of the people that they're trying to investigate. And, something like the Daily Mirror it's got some serious journalism in it, but a lot of it, frankly, isn't journalism at all. It's just,
well, a lot of it is just cut and pasted from the wire services, like the Press Association, straight in there.
Yeah, but a lot of what people are buying the Daily Mirror for is, the Agony Ant column or whatever it is. Assange has done it. I don't see him as a tabloid editor. I mean, basically, he's going to be a future historian like Robert Fisk. Robert Fisk was a historian as well as being a journalist,
What about Paul Foote in the Mirror years ago? He used to do some really good, sharp-edged investigations.
Well, indeed. And you don't see much of that anymore. But, of course, Assange is on another level from Paul Foote. I mean, Assange basically has exposed at the very heart of the establishment all sorts of evil actions, and the mechanism by which he's exposed it has also made them terrified of what to do and to keep their own secrets. That's why they're being so vindictive towards it.
Yeah, that's right. And also, I mean, I've heard anecdotally that many of these rich and powerful, particularly oligarchs, are should we say, in big inverted commas, paranoid about email. So they don't want any record of what they're doing. So they're the sort of people who will not be doing what we're doing, which is, communicating online, etc. They will be only meeting people in person because they're paranoid that the various microphones and the computers around them will be listening to what they're saying. So I suppose that, maybe still the internet is out. They want to wrestle the internet back off of us, don't they?
Yes. And this is the new kind of journalism, you know. I mean, the old kind of investigative journalism, something like Paul Foote or Seymour Hersh or Robert Fisk or John Pilger, was part of a mainstream organisation, but they were given their head. They've squeezed all that out years ago. The internet then gave a voice to the voiceless, but of course the big tech companies now control that. So what happens over time is you can do something once, but then they work out what's happening and they take countermeasures. So, for example, in the 80s, it was the big cities in the US who decided that they were going to take their pension funds out of South Africa. And because they did that, the South African government ultimately had to capitulate. It was really important. But of course, what's now happened with the Israelis lobbying inside the United States, they've made it illegal for pension funds for local authorities to have any kind of political bias in what they invest in. So in other words, even if we were able to get a boycott and divestment campaign against Israel through local authorities or big city governments in the US, they wouldn't be able to do anything because they're by law they're not allowed to do these things.
But anyway, just talking about investigative journalism, I came across this story this week from Hong Kong. Her name is Choi Yuk Ling. She's an investigative journalist for the state broadcaster in Hong Kong. And on the 21st of July last year, she found herself very close to a place called Yuen Long, which is a tube station. It's a district of Hong Kong, on the mainland, where there was a horrific incident where a group of about 40 men dressed in these white coats attacked with metal bars a whole load of demonstrators who'd been in the city centre demonstrating against the Extradition Act coming back home. And as they got off the tube trains, they laid into them. And apparently these triads are specialists at beating people up without killing them. So there were lots of people who were hospitalised, but nobody who was actually killed. So this is the big Hong Kong story, which the news networks in the West don't want to talk about. The arrest of Hong Kong state broadcaster's investigative journalist, Choi Yuk Ling. So I spoke earlier on this week, yesterday, in fact, to a guy called Chris Young. He is the chairman of the Hong Kong Journalists Association. And Chris explained a bit about this Yuen Long incident. What was it all about? And what was Choi Yuk Ling's involvement? Because she's now been arrested.
Where is the investigation going with the attack on the demonstrators? Because quite clearly, I mean, anyone that's seen the footage will be shocked. You've got guys dressed up in these white costumes with metal bars attacking literally scores and scores of ordinary civilians as they come off the MTR, you know, the metro, the railway station at Yuen Long. How's the investigation going into who carried that out, why, and have there been arrests? Are people in jail?
Police have made arrests of dozens of people, actually. Most of them are those are white shirt being identified, have been involved in this attack. But they had also arrested what we call the black shirt persons, and including a pro-democracy legislators, for being involved in what they call rioting in those areas. That had been interpreted as a rewrite of history by the police that originally, I think most people define the case of triad-related elements in right attacking civilians and passengers in those areas. But the police actually had a different interpretation, saying that it's a clash between two groups of people. There were quarrels, there were disputes, and then they were involved in the violence, assaulted. So they made arrests of people from both sides. That's also a matter of great controversy, because that's not what most people define the case when.
Well, no, that's not what's in the film either. If you have a look at the footage shot, the film taken, it's not. It's really not anything but a one-way fight.
Yes, that's exactly. But they say, well, why it happened? Because there might be, say, incitement by those being attacked. I think those will be put to court, and the court will make judgment. And so far, of course, more people in right were arrested. But yes, there were other arrests of other persons, including those being attacked. One of them is a legislator, yeah.
So with Choi Yuk-ling, with her, what is she actually being arrested for? Is it to do with somehow supporting the pro-democracy people, the protest against the extradition? Is that why she's been arrested?
Well, that's the most ridiculous part of this arrest, because she was arrested for making a false statement in a car play search. She did a search of those vehicles for digging out to the bottom of truth of who were there, who owned that vehicle, were there during the attack. So what she did is just normal professionals reporting, investigative journalism. But because in the CarPlay search document, she had to fill in the form, picking from there the purpose of the search, and in the document there's no explicit item of for news reporting. But for other, say, business or just, vehicle-related matters. So the police, seems to be making use of those technical requirements and, to make a prosecution, ignoring the clear fact that she used the information for news reporting, which is in the public interest, and that's the most controversial part, and that's why journalists here are up in arms against it, because those CarPlay search is quite common. It's quite common for news reporting.
So yes, that's Chris Yung, who's chairman of the Hong Kong Journalists Association, talking about this arrest this week, Martin. Of someone who's basically just doing their job. So what she's done is she's got the number plates of vehicles that were seen, which the triads had used to get to the tube station before they beat up the demonstrators. And by tracing those back, she is now apparently she is being prosecuted. She's been arrested. She's now been released on bail. But this is a cause célèbre over in Hong Kong right now. People are rather disturbed that journalists aren't going to be allowed to do their job. Of course, the main thing here is, why has this really not been reported in the West? And of course, the answer to that is because it involves, I think anyway, it involves secret societies, the whole linkage between the triads and the Hong Kong police.
Well, I mean, there are various speculations one can make from this kind of distance about something like that, but you'll find that the oligarchy in Hong Kong, if you like, Lukashing, etc., who gave money to the Conservative Party in the past and all the rest of it, they have pretty strong links with the underworld, as most oligarchs do, and you know that's probably what's behind all of this. The demonstrators are being a nuisance as far as they're concerned, and so you know they then you know carry out this provocation to try and intimidate them. I'm only guessing, because of course it could well be, you see, in other circumstances, demonstrators being attacked by police actually or by third parties actually makes them more determined to demonstrate rather than less, and it can be used as a provocation tactic the other way, if you see what I mean, as a way of getting you're trying to actually make the demonstrators look good and the authorities look bad. I'm not saying that's the case here. I just don't know.
The long and short of it, though, is that this is quite a big, the idea is just trying to stop people demonstrating. Surely that's the idea, is that if you're going to get beaten up, you're going to think twice about leaving the house to join a demonstration.
Well, that's the ostensible one. That's the obviously straightforward explanation. But you could also have don't forget that the demonstrators are themselves being, supported and manipulated by Western intelligence services, and having your demonstrators beaten up. What's interesting is that it's not been reported. I mean, this is the first time I've heard about this anyway, although I think I did hear something about it at the time. I mean, the other thing that has barely been reported in the West is a lot of the demonstrators were, in fact, they basically petrol bombed a tube station and virtually destroyed it. Hardly mentioned in the West. Now, who was pulling the strings there?
Well, yeah, good question. I mean, this is taking place against the backdrop of a kind of Cold War that started. What do you know about these triads? I tend to think, well, they're kind of similar to the Freemasons in the West. So it's not as if the Chinese don't have their own kind of version. The triads started apparently around about the 1760s, the same era as the Freemasons started to get a grip on the United States, because obviously that was quite an important, but the Masons took a very great role there in what you might now call the New World Order. But what is a triad, and is it any different to, say, an organization run by the Freemasons?
Well, the Freemasons were an intellectually oriented organization that recruited business people with, and all the rest of it. The triads are like the Italian mafia or the 'Ndrangheta. They're essentially a criminal organization which will have ally, basically they buy politicians, etc., as required. The modern triads are far more powerful in Hong Kong than they would be in mainland China. I mean, where they are now, and how powerful they are in relation to things like the Yakuza and so on. You've got to remember that the logic of conglomeration is even stronger in the criminal economy than it is in the legal economy, and ultimately, criminal organizations have eventually become dominated by one organization.
Well, yeah, but I mean, Mark, this thing in the 1760s, the Heaven and Earth Society, which is apparently the original triad, was very much in mainland China, and the British Hong Kong was intolerant of secret societies. Let's remember also, this is something I discovered when I was over there, is that Singapore is the only place, as far as I know, in the world that has a special CID department devoted to stopping these secret societies. They infiltrate them, they prosecute them, but most of the rest of the world, secret societies are seen as part of the norm if you want to be part of this. But of course, a secret society, as in this case with the triads, can easily conceal a criminal organization.
Yes, and there's a whole spectrum of organizations, more and less criminal, more and less secret, and there isn't just one model, is there? I mean, Freemasonry in the West is based around a certain ideology, which obviously doesn't necessarily mean much in practical terms when propaganda stuff in Italy. It's not necessarily to do with traditional Freemason ideology.
I think it was Carl Jung that said the maintenance of secrets acts like a psychic poison that alienates the possessors from the community.
Yes. Secrecy is, MI6 is a secret organization. Do we know who's in it? No, we don't. Are they, how do we control what they do and don't do? Is there any?
Well, that's
the
Intelligence and Security Committee's job.
Sorry?
That's the job of the Intelligence and Security Committee.
Well, in theory, yes. But I mean, the point is that there are different secret societies. I mean, the Irish Republican Brotherhood was a secret society, but it wasn't like the triads, except in the fact sense that it was secret. You can't just make all secret societies the same because they're secret. I mean, yeah, there are lots of different secret societies, but they've all got different goals and values and different things that they're trying to achieve. It doesn't, they don't all add up to one thing.
Well, not necessarily, because sometimes, of course, they could be working in concert. You know, there's no reason why they can't. Anyway, look, let's have a look at the wider perspective. One of the things I spoke to Chris Young about was, look, let's take a step back from Hong Kong. How does this incident at Yuen Long fit into the US-China conspiracy theories and this kind of US-China Cold War? So let's have a listen to that now.
The Cold War between US and China is certainly one of the factors that has significantly changed the Communist Party's world will, and that certainly has an implication on how they or why they say harden their stance on Hong Kong. But there's also a very significant domestic factor that in the last 23 years after the 1997 handover, the developments in Hong Kong, or perhaps the way Hong Kong goes under one country. There's a lot of things that China feels worry, feels angry. For instance, what they call the sentiments of young people. They would expect that new generations will say have stronger sense of identity or nationhood, but the opposite is true. That there's a strong sense of Hong Kong identity, and up to a point that what the Chinese fears as pro-independence thinking here, and and that Western or Western force element further complicates the Hong Kong issue. And they see what happened in Hong Kong as what they call color revolution, and Western forces trying to work with the local independent activists to trying to split Hong Kong, separate Hong Kong, from the rest of China. So that China-US Cold War, development had just deepened their fears. And then cases like what you said, Meng Wanzhou, and factor, I think, adds more controversy into the way they think about the world. So that's an element, that's a factor, but not just one. A lot of things had happened, and unfortunately, I think being interpreted, seen as from the perspective of conspiracy by the Chinese Communist government.
That's Chris Young there, and I'll put the full-length version of that interview up on our show page later at thisweek.org.uk. Fascinating conversation with the sort of beleaguered heart of Hong Kong journalism. All I say is there isn't really journalism in China. You could argue that there's a great lack of it in the West these days, but certainly you're not allowed to criticize, you're not allowed to say the words like, I think Hong Kong might be better off independent. If you say that, you go to jail in China. So there isn't journalism. What there is a kind of Ministry of Information announcement service. And of course, the people in Hong Kong, the journalists working there, are feeling very threatened. But I did ask Chris about that. And he said, well, actually, if you don't write what you really think, then you may as well not bother. So he and his journalist association are determined to keep reporting what they can of the truth before, I suppose, they eventually get arrested and thrown into jail. So I think they're a fantastic, brave lot, Martin.
Well, I mean, I hear what's being said there. But of course, he's quite right that the conflict between Hong Kong, between China and the West is intensifying. And the Chinese government has plenty of faults about it, but then so does the United States. I mean, how many of the demonstrators in Hong Kong are aware that the 9/11 attack was carried out by the US security forces? The Chinese Communist Party don't go on about it. The Chinese Communist Party keeps shtum, but they presumably know. Do the demonstrators know?
Well, I mean, in a way, it's a bit like all these kind of very strict measures to do with COVID. That journalism, I mean, look at what's happened to Assange. It's almost as if journalism is being crushed in the West, almost to line up with the way it is now in China.
Well, it's interestingly enough, Ai Weiwei, who's a prominent critic of the Chinese government, even though his family were originally Communist Party, I mean, he's the artist, he has come out publicly and said that Assange is being crushed by the state in the West, just as happens in China. So he's very anti, you know. And I saw a documentary that he put together, which was all about the treatment of refugees, and it was a very kind of pro-refugee documentary. And he's regarded as persona non grata really now in China, but he's at least consistent in that he said, well, Assange is being, this is just exactly the same as in communist China, and he's just being, you know, people are being silenced. And, you know, when people show consistency like that, I'm willing to listen to what they've got to say.
Absolutely. Blessings and good wishes to all the journalists still trying to tell the truth over in Hong Kong. Martin, we're going to turn now to have a listen to Whitney Webb and her discussion on the Global Research News Hour this week. About Operation Warp Speed. Now, what is Operation Warp Speed?
Well, it was set up by Trump and various other acolytes, you know, and I think various other people that around him to try and, you know, and they use the word warp speed because it was from Star Trek, to try and get a US vaccine for the US in warp speed time. And, you know, so loads of people have had loads of public money chucked at them in order to develop a vaccine, which Trump, I mean, presumably what Trump's motivation was, if he could roll this vaccine out before the election yesterday or earlier in the week, then it would have been a massive triumph for him, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, but it didn't happen, did it?
No.
Anyway, here's Whitney Webb, and here she explains why the American vaccine program, this Operation Warp Speed, is really a military program. It's not a civilian program. And of course, that raises all sorts of questions.
Top FDA officials were barred from even sitting in on Operation Warp Speeds, let alone participating. They can't even sit in and listen to what's going on. Essentially, there's only one woman from the FDA involved in the leadership of Operation Warp Speed. She was described by Stat News as essentially a one-woman firewall that allows the information from Operation Warp Speed to be channeled into the FDA, greatly limiting the amount of the flow of information between Operation Warp Speed and the Food and Drug Administration. And this is of concern because Operation Warp Speed is not only stonewalling and barring public health officials from meetings, it is honestly operating under the utmost secrecy. Their vaccine contracts are largely secret. They were set to be immune from Freedom of Information Act requests, but some members of Congress found out about that after I reported about it. And they ended up complaining, and then Operation Warp Speed released two of their contracts, two of the six, I believe, vaccine contracts that are part of the operation. But, I mean, most of those contracts were redacted in their entirety. So in terms of transparency, I don't really know if it's really as transparent as they can claim. Most of those vaccine contracts through Operation Warp Speed were not made directly by the U.S. government and the vaccine companies, as is custom. Instead, they were routed through a third-party intermediary called ATI, which is a subsidiary of Answer. Answer, of course, being the main sponsor of Dark Winter back in June 2001. And by routing the vaccine contracts through this third-party intermediary, not only are you able to obfuscate the Freedom of Information Act process, but you also make those it also allows these vaccine companies to operate without normal federal safety regulations and federal oversight, which would have been different if the contracts had been made directly between the U.S. government and the vaccine companies. So it allows the vaccine companies, many of which have very unfortunate track records with regards to product safety, like Johnson & Johnson, for example, allows them to develop these vaccines, without federal safety regulations and federal oversight, giving them billions of dollars to spend as they please, and their contracts are largely redacted and not available to the public. In addition to the minimal involvement of public health officials and the dominance of the military, we now know that other parts of the United States government that have become involved in Operation Warp Speed since it was announced in May include the National Security Agency, or the NSA, and DHS, the Department of Homeland Security, and the FBI. Why they need to be involved in a vaccination program? Your guess is as good as mine. I don't really, I frankly think it's quite odd that this is a medical countermeasure, i.e. a vaccine, being funded by American taxpayers to be injected into American taxpayers during peacetime, when there is no war taking place, no bioterror or anything like that. But yet the military and not really the national security state, if you count the NSA and DHS, are, you know, involved in this operation. Even public health officials don't really know what's going on. It definitely looks, as mainstream media has even been forced to admit, Warp Speed looks more like a military operation than a science project. And I think anyone looking at you know, what I've just laid out, definitely should have more questions about what's going on here. It's definitely concerning. And a lot of these vaccines that are being essentially developed in secret without a lot of federal oversight are being rushed through under the guise of speed, getting the vaccine out as quickly as possible, and essentially circumventing normal vaccine approval processes. And that's why it's important to point out that every single Operation Warp Speed vaccine candidate, none of them use technology that vaccine production methods that have ever been licensed or marketed, taken to market before. Every existing vaccine in the United States that has been approved for use uses different methods than the ones that Operation Warp Speed is using. And Operation Warp Speed admits that these vaccine production technologies that are part of this operation have limited, if any, safety tests done in humans prior to these currently ongoing COVID-19 vaccine trials. And of course, we've seen those trials paused on several occasions for safety concerns. There was even a person that died from one in Brazil from the AstraZeneca vaccine, which is also part of Operation Warp Speed. It's definitely concerning. And a lot of those clinical, the parameters of those studies are also secret, like much of the rest of the operation.
So that's Whitney Webb there on the Global Research News Hour, Martin. I mean, this does sound, doesn't it, as if it's a highly secretive organization. And probably the most worrying aspect of it is this thing that was pointed out on this show by Julie Beale a couple of months ago, who was one of the first people that flagged up this whole thing of digital identifications to us probably 8 years ago or something, is that these technologies are not going to be ever having properly been trialed, and that the technologies have been around for decades, and yet they've never been able to get them through the trials. This opportunity, as the vaccine companies see it, of COVID-19 is to get these new things out there into the public, into the marketplace, without having to go through all the hoops that they used to in the past.
Well, that's certainly worrying, as she's pointed out. Perhaps to elucidate for the listeners, Dark Winter was a war game that took place before 9/11, which basically was an anthrax attack on the United States, supposedly carried out by an alliance between Al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein, even though, of course, they were basically at daggers drawn. And then the same people involved in that were related to Fort Detrick, where there was, in fact, an anthrax component to the post 9/11 situation, where anthrax from Fort Detrick, it's quite clear it was US anthrax, although at the time it wasn't clear, was sent to various politicians who were likely to vote against the Patriot Act. And at the same time, after Dark Winter, Dick Cheney and various other people in the know were taking Cyprion, I think it is, which is an anti-anthrax prophylactic. So they clearly knew that there was going to be an anthrax attack. They were already taking the antidotes, and the anthrax attack freaked out the politicians so that they all herded like sheep into the lobby to pass the Patriot Act. And it turned out that the actual anthrax itself ultimately came from Fort Detrick, and that the personnel who were involved in all of that are the same people that are involved in Warp Speed. I mean, I can't do justice to the fantastic investigative journalism that Whitney Webb has carried out on all this. It's a four-part series, which people can read on the web. It's very detailed. Names, points the fingers. And, of course, underlying all of this, really, to put my tuppence halfpenny in, I think that the COVID pandemic is a false flag weapon attack. It was an attack on the Chinese initially, and it's an attack on everybody. But that doesn't mean that there isn't a virus out there. It's a weapon, and it's not just accidental.
Well, we did report that back in February, the first show we did in February, when we were still on FM before Pat Hart removed our program from Bristol Community Radio. We reported the Zero Hedge report of the New Delhi University Virology Department report saying having looked at the genome of the virus published by the Chinese and the Pasteur Institute in France, that it looked to them as if this was wouldn't have occurred naturally. It had a spike of SARS on it. This is basically a coronavirus, which is a normal common cold, but it had an additional spike of SARS attached to it, and another spike of AIDS attached to it. And we've seen, obviously, through the chloroquine, which has been used to treat it successfully in many parts of the world. Funnily enough, Martin, I'm not sure if you know this, but in India, they shipped loads and loads of chloroquine to Africa. So many people in Africa and India have been being treated with chloroquine, whereas there's been an attempt to prevent treatment of COVID patients with chloroquine in the West. And the problem here is that with SARS, you get a very similar symptom to pneumonia. So whereas many people in the West were being treated for pneumonia, it could be that the actual thing they needed to be treated was SARS. And at the same time as all this was happening, you had the World Health Organization actually getting rid of the name SARS from the virus and changing it from SARS-CoV-2 into something called COVID-19. So loads and loads of stuff to untangle. But, of course, Whitney does a superb job. I think it's Mint Press News that she publishes a lot of her material on.
She's off there now. She's Last American Vagabond is the website.
Which is an excellent website. Well worth it. I think what we'll do is we'll just put a link up to Whitney on Last American Vagabond at our show page at thisweek.org.uk. But look, moving on to the sort of, quasi supernatural here, because Lance Murdoch, who's LLMC, was on this program about a month ago, maybe 3 weeks ago, talking about Serco and giving us a long insight into what he thinks is going on. And I thought we had to get him back on because, when he was on back then, he said, oh, keep an eye on Halloween. I think something big is going to happen on Halloween. I know how these people's minds work, and they like to do things on sorts of days. He describes them as dark occultists. I would probably describe it more as the forces of darkness. But let's have a listen now to Lance Murdoch, his take on, I spoke to him this week about that prediction that he made. Of course, on Halloween, what we had was a blue moon, which is very rare, which is where you have two moons in the same month, and the first one on Halloween for something like 20 years. But as he explains here, there were lots of other different types of moon that were happening last Saturday as the moon was rising at 6 o'clock here in the afternoon, evening in Britain. So Boris Johnson was making his speech about the second lockdown, this doom-laden speech about another load of lockdown that we're going to have to go through. Of course, the dark forces like the moon. The moon is a kind of their version of the sun. The sun is what we do, which is getting things out into the light, shining the light on subjects. But the moon is that kind of their version, which is a dim and dark version, a nighttime version. They like to do their stuff at night, hopefully when nobody's looking. But so let's have a listen anyway to what Lance had to say this week. As I invited him back on to talk about his correct prediction about something interesting political happening on Halloween, which it very much did. At the same time, as that Halloween moon was rising, we had Boris Johnson's announcing the second lockdown, another month, and maybe more. Who knows?
For a very, very long time, I've been researching the beliefs of what people would call the occult and Freemasons and all different incarnations and manifestations of occult knowledge. The power of numbers, the power of frequencies, the power of certain dates. And I've also studied the modus operandi of the global elite to a really sort of perverse level. And I found out that they're actually super predictable. So a lot of my best work is actually reverse engineered intuition. So this is how it goes with this prediction. On the 1st of October, which was a full moon, Boris announced what I called the rule of 666. Six people, 6 feet, 2 meters apart for 6 months. And that really struck me. And on the 2nd of October, I learned that there was a very, very rare lunar cycle in October. First full moon on the 1st and the second full moon on the 31st, which was a hunter's harvest blue moon. A blue moon is once every 3 years. A harvest moon is that particular time of the year. A hunter's moon is slightly rarer. But all of those three happening all at once, my research told me the last time it happened was 1955. As soon as I heard that, I instinctively knew in my heart that day, because not only is it that, it's All Hallows Eve, it's Halloween, which is a very, very, that's like Christmas Day for dark occultists. You know, Halloween is not just a children's holiday for bobbing apples. It goes back thousands of years when human sacrifice was openly practiced and all the other stuff like that. So it's a very, very important day for dark occultists. So as soon as I found out about this very rare occurrence, it was no stretch of the imagination that a lockdown was going to be coming for the winter. But I just knew in my heart instantly October the 31st would be the day it'd be announced. As it approached the day, and I kept saying in interviews, including your one, mate, I thought to myself, do you know what, though? I've got it wrong, because I've looked at their patterns and they only ever make announcements on Fridays and Mondays for the preceding or following Friday or Monday. And lo and behold, the 31st fell on a Saturday. And I was actually doing a speech in Bournemouth on the same bench where I made the original prediction. And as I was talking about it, I said, well, I saw in the newspaper yesterday, the Friday, that it looks like he's going to announce it. So I was one day out, and in the middle of the speech, someone corrected me and goes, no, they literally just announced it today. And I was like, I don't want to be right. But yeah, there you go. It will be announced. Well, I always said it would be announced on the 31st. With just that extra little twist, the extra little special twist, it is enacted on the 5th of November. These people love dates. Dates, numbers, gematria is super important to them, to a level that the uninitiated couldn't possibly understand.
These people, is Boris one of them? Do you think he's aware of all this?
Probably not. Boris is of the baron merchant class, that is an employee or an agent for these people. Whether Boris has ever attended a ceremony with any actual occult practices or not, that go past burning a £50 note in front of a homeless person, I doubt it. He takes their money. He does their bidding. I've seen him with his UN Agenda 2030 badge and stood in front of the Build Back Better. I don't know if anyone else has seen that. There's the sign Build Back Better. You see like Macron in front of it, Boris. You see it in Chinese as well, because I've had it translated into Chinese. And what it is, it relates to the Great Reset. It's the rebuild plan for post-reset world. There's only one, and I keep coming back to it, there's only one world leader that I've seen that has never been pictured in front of this sigil of Build Back Better, and it's Trump. That's the only one I couldn't find a photo of. So next time you see a world leader and they're in front of some sort of like billboard or stand, look at the words behind it. So look for Build Back Better. If it's another language, get out your Google Translate. Very interesting.
These people, though, I mean, it's all very well to talk about, these dark occultists, blah, blah, but they do surely have names and addresses, lads.
Well, okay. I mean, let's take it to the level of people that we can name. Above the level of prime ministers and presidents, you have your agents and hitmen, men like George Soros and Warren Buffett, who are financial, philanthropic, charitable feudalism. You know, these guys are sort of the agents. Whether they are into the actual occult practices or not is debatable. I mean, there are plenty of witnesses that say people like that, presidents, are involved in those things. There's, you know, there's hundreds of testimonies. But above that, then you've got sort of like, you know, in the visible level, you have people like Klaus Schwab. You have obviously members of the unspeakable families. A couple of them begin with R. But at the most fundamental level of understanding, people have to appreciate that they are still employees. They are not the owners of the world. The Kabbalistic banking priest class, as they have been coined, that, you know, we can allege took hold in the late 1600s and 1666 with the self-anointment of a messianic character called Shabbatai Zevi, or Shabatsky, as he was known. And he actually took Kabbalistic Judaism and inverted it. So sin out of redemption, instead of fasting, feasting, basically turned it into a satanic cult. We had a million followers. And the founders of the Federal Reserve and the Bavarian, what was called the Bavarian Illuminati, the Weishaupts, they were all Sabbatean Frankists. So it's actually an evil, it's actually a cult.
So that's Lance Murdoch there, Martin. I mean, he goes one step beyond you, doesn't he, really? He's saying that this is a formal organised elite here, which is much more like a cult with its own sort of religious beliefs. And they're really the owners of the world. The people like Boris, the others that we see, you know, the other elected people, are literally puppets.
Well, I think Boris is literally a puppet. I don't think there's much doubt about that. He is, you know, he's the creature of bigger forces. I was listening quite closely to that, and if you actually think about it, I'm not going to buy into all of that, because I'm basically a political conspiracy theorist. I don't really believe in occult explanations of things. But if you actually look at when the lockdown announcement was made on the Saturday. Because on the Friday, they'd agreed that there was going to be a lockdown, but it leaked. Somehow, the decision that was made by Boris, Rishi Sunak, Matt Hancock and Gove leaked. And that's why they had to do the announcement on the Saturday. But don't forget that the Sage people had been calling for a lockdown some weeks previously. And so had Keir Starmer found out about that. And then he said, I'm calling for a lockdown, because what Sage is calling for a lockdown. And they were calling for a lockdown over the half-term holiday. So it wouldn't have fitted in with Halloween at all if it had played out that way. Now, what your friend there is trying to suggest is that this series of concatenations and basically cock-ups, including that it was leaked on the Friday, led to the thing being announced on the Saturday.
Well, now, what he's suggesting is that they pulled the wool over your eyes. It's really an in-joke that they all, you know, laugh at this. Look what we can do. We're doing it on Halloween, and it's not a coincidence at all.
Well, you can say that, and I would say that I'd rather talk about the bombings in Moscow in 1999. How much does he know about that? What have the Illuminati got to do with it? It's probably got more to do with Chechen politics. Does he know anything about Chechen politics? It wasn't the Chechens. It probably was the FSB working with Western intelligence services.
Well, I mean, what you're saying is that there's a prosaic reason for it, which is fine. I mean, that's just a different opinion, which is fine. But, you know, I don't think you should expect him to know a load of stuff that you know.
Well, no, I'm just saying that people have their own spheres of
knowledge, Martin. You have to let me finish the sentence. People have their own spheres of knowledge, don't they?
Yeah, but I'm not willing to concede my sphere of knowledge to him.
Anyway, one of the things that Lance was talking about was this up-and-coming film. I believe it's out now, Maybe it's beginning of next year. The trailer is out anyway, called Songbird. And so I thought what we'd do is have a little bit of a listen to this feature film from Hollywood. I mean, as we've seen many times in the past, you've got films which have a psychological effect on the population and almost kind of trigger things that may be going to happen in the future. We had films about, building airliners crashing into buildings in New York before the 9/11 attacks and that sort of thing. So, maybe these ideas find their way into Hollywood before they actually become reality. But in this case, the film Songbird is about this never-ending lockdown. So let's have a listen to a bit of the trailer for that film now.
Good morning, Miss Garcia.
Good morning, sunshine. I miss you. I could kiss you right now.
Yeah, well, Sunday.
Curfew is now in effect. All unauthorized citizens must stay indoors.
Tensions rise as we enter the 213th week of lockdown.
A grim new reality emerges.
COVID-23 has mutated.
Beginning thermal scan. Thermal scan normal.
A horrifying new development
new
today.
New data confirms the virus attacks the brain tissue.
Whoa, 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 whoa! I'm immune!
Worldwide death toll rises to over 110 million.
All infected Americans are being forced into quarantine camps.
Sarah, what's going on?
Department of Sanitation.
I think my neighbor has a fever.
It'll be so much easier if you just open the door. Mrs. Grant, you have visitors.
Sarah, please. Sarah, open the door.
Sarah, do not open that door.
No! Please! I'm not safe! I'm not safe!
Beginning thermal scan. 3, 2, 1. Anomaly detected. Armed guards will be arriving. You must not attempt to leave your home, or you will be shot on sight.
I know you're in there.
They're coming.
Sometimes we have to do things we don't want to survive.
I'm trying to save the one person left in my life that matters to me.
I can't help you. What you're talking about is illegal.
So that's a trailer for the film Songbird coming out, Martin. The basic plot of the film is set in 2022. A pandemic ravages the world and its cities, centering on a handful of people as they navigate the obstacles currently hindering society. Disease, martial law, quarantine, and vigilante. So in a way, this is a prediction of the way things could go. It's also been, criticized by some for being exploitation of the current situation. But Hollywood is quite good at doing this sort of thing, isn't it? I guess the idea is to scare people even more than they've already been scared.
Well, surely what's important in relation to this film is, when was it made? Was it made before all of this, or was it made after all of this kicked in?
It's been made during the COVID-19 Hollywood.
In that case, what you're dealing with is something. I mean, what is more suspicious, as you pointed out earlier, is when you get films which seem to be prescient of what's going to happen next in the world. And there's quite strong evidence to suggest that lots of pre-planning goes into things like false flag attacks. And one of the things that you do, we mentioned earlier, for example, the takedown of Muslim websites the day before the attack. But one of the other things that they do is they implant in the popular consciousness the possibility that something might happen, which then does happen. And that is part of psychological warfare.
Well, you could also do that with this film, couldn't you? I mean, Martin, you could do that with this film very easily. If you sit and watch the film, I'm sure you'll see certain things happen in the film which may actually then, may seem incredible to anyone watching the film, but then may come to pass in the future.
Yeah, but if it's been made after the COVID-19 epidemic had begun, then it doesn't have the same valency. If it was something, I mean, we know that there were various war games of a pandemic last year, don't we? Which built the Bill Gates, what's it, the Event 201 or whatever. Yeah.
Well, yes, ID 2020, an event. Let's crack on and listen to hear what Lance has to say about the film and a couple of other things as well. I mean, I think he's someone that, does believe that there are deliberate psychological reasons why films like this come out of Hollywood at times like right now.
Through the media and through things like through Hollywood. I mean, so many Hollywood. Have you seen that Hollywood film that's about to come out? From Michael Bay, it's called something like A Silent Song, and it's a view of 2023 where everyone, the whole world's been under lockdown for 200 weeks, and it's a COVID-23, and it is absolutely unbelievable. Basically, you're locked in your house, you've got a temperature sensor which you have to breathe into every day, and if your temperature's too high, it goes beep beep beep, armed guards coming in 6 hours, and you get taken away by riot police. And and it's like, you know, that is for that's telling us, that is literally in your face telling you, here is the plan, here is how it's going to go. And don't think that they don't have, you know, the technology is there to gauge every single type of reaction from that. I've got a little update about vaccines and credit scores, right? Since we last spoke, there was a BBC reporter on the ground in Wuhan, and there was a queue of people queuing up for the vaccine that was being administered. And this one woman, really visibly shaken up, really upset. And the BBC reporter went up to her, like, are you okay? She's like, yeah, I'm very scared. I'm very scared about the vaccine, but I must get it because I have 30 extra credit points for my social score. This will allow me many things. And then she went in, got vaccinated, came out, and she was all happy. Yes, now no more COVID, like a totally different person. Maybe it was the effect on her of having her extra 30 credit points that now allowed her to go and visit her family in another province, or allowed her to get her higher internet speed or her other privileges. But the vaccine was a prerequisite for those 30 points. And it seemed like that 30 points was a very significant upgrade to her social credit score. And that really struck me. I thought that's it. There you go. That's all you need to know about how it works.
Okay, so that's Lance Murdoch there. I'll put a full version of that interview up on our show page later, thisweek.org.uk. Thanks very much, Lance, for joining us again. He does make another prediction, so if that comes true, I guess we'll be having him on again in a month's time. But Martin, this what he finished up by talking about there, this social credit system in China, how pernicious is that? You're told that you can't travel. You're basically going to be limited to having to stay within your own immediate district, etc., unless you have your vaccination, and then you get 30 super points on your social credit score. I mean, this really is a form of dystopia that the Chinese are introducing.
Well, let's just unpick this a bit. First of all, he said it was a BBC report he saw of people being given a vaccine in
Wuhan. So you're saying it's not true?
No, I'm just trying to unpick what he said. I've only just heard it. So he said he's seen a BBC report of people having vaccinations in Wuhan, and a BBC reporter, those evil BBC people, asked the woman what she's worried about. I've not heard of any. They haven't got a vaccine yet, have they? Or have they? Have I missed something?
Yeah, carry on.
Well, okay, so that's the first question in my mind is, hang on a minute, they're developing vaccines in Russia and in China, but they're still testing them. They haven't run them out yet. So I don't know where he's got that from.
Well, AstraZeneca's vaccine has been going through clinical trials in China. Martin, maybe she was queuing up for a trial.
Yeah, okay, well, that may be so, but he claims he's seen it on a BBC report. That should be checkable.
And also, The Guardian has been reporting that there are experimental vaccines being used in China for students going abroad. They are taking a vaccine before they leave.
Okay, but anyway, I'll be interested to know what BBC report he's drawn that particular.
And China, in the Foreign Affairs Journal from the Council on Foreign Relations, is saying that the Chinese are winning the vaccine race, which is hardly surprising. But anyway, there certainly are vaccine trials and vaccinations being given for COVID in China right now.
OK, I still come back to my point. Which BBC report, because he said BBC journalist, had reported this? I've got my computer on.
So there is a BBC report which says hundreds are queuing in China for experimental COVID-19 vaccine. Okay. Well, they're taking part in the trial.
Now we're unpicking it. So, in other words, people are queuing for the experimental vaccine, and if they get it, then they get a big boost on their social credit. So that's what we're talking about here.
I mean, we had in the West, didn't we? We were reporting last week that people are basically being bribed to get their friends to sign up to these vaccine trials. So there is a lot of pressure being put on people, which is, you know, particularly maybe vulnerable people who have a low amount of money in their bank account or a low social credit score to get involved in these potentially damaging trials where they may potentially, I'm not saying they will, but they may actually suffer physically because of it, taking part almost like guinea pigs.
Yep. But I mean, in a sense, if you're going to have any vaccine and you're going to test it so that you don't just bash it out there to hell with the consequences, somebody has to take it first. I mean, I understand in Russia, they've been given their experimental vaccine to frontline medical staff and presumably possibly also people in the military.
Well, what happened to doing animal trials?
Yeah, well, I'm not sure where we're at on all of this, because in actual fact, it may well be that there is no vaccine for this anyway. So it may be if a vaccine suddenly miraculously appears and somebody seems that they've miraculously solved all the problems, that's when my suspicions would lie.
Yeah, me too. I mean, look. It does look absolutely clear, whatever our disagreements may be on vaccines, that there is an attempt here to coerce and basically try and force people to take part in these trials because the vaccine companies aren't managing to get volunteers to try out something effectively to be guinea pigs, you know, for something which has never been tested, let alone on animals, but on humans before.
Well, as Whitney Webb pointed out, what's the problem with the warp speed stuff is they're not using tried and tested vaccine technology. This is a whole new technology which intervenes in the body at the level of DNA. So they're not even just developing basic vaccines.
I mean, it is incredible. It is incredible, isn't it? You know, the coronavirus has been around for centuries. Certainly, since the invention of vaccines by Edward Jenner down the road here near Sharpness, they haven't come up with any kind of vaccine for the coronavirus. And yet now all these companies are being told you must find a vaccine. It does sound as if it may never find one, Martin.
Well, that then sort of puts a big question mark on all the paranoia about the vaccine. The vaccine companies are Western multinational companies who've done all sorts of appalling things in the developing world. John le Carré's book that was made into a film, The Constant Gardener, was all about the bad behaviour of Western pharmaceutical companies in Africa. Absolutely on board with that completely. If you've got a for-profit health system, that's what it looks like. And of course, that's what they've not got in somewhere like Cuba, where they don't have access to all of these Western whiz-bang stuff. They've got to develop their own stuff their own way under a completely different regime where profit doesn't come into it. So there's a debate that we don't often have on this show about the difference between the for-profit vaccine complex in the West and the not-for-profit vaccines which are being developed in the communist world, because that's what it is. Now that's before we get to wider questions of, you know, what's going on here, what's underlying.
It seems to me you've got enormous attempts both in the West and in China to get around this idea of informed consent, where you consent to being used as people to experiment on you because you wish to. There's all sorts of ways of trying to coerce people into doing this. And of course, there may be a vaccine come along, Martin, which has very little to do with stopping COVID-19, which has all sorts of other effects on you, you know, like altering your DNA, that sort of thing. And who knows, it might work, it might not. It's actually very difficult to tell whether it does, especially since we've got all this obfuscation around testing and around whether the tests actually are of somebody who's got a disease or a virus in their system or not. Anyway, look, let's just go to look at this little publication I'm doing. This is the first time I've done this, really, of my Traitors of Arnhem book. It was first suggested to me that I should do a book on the subject by a guy called Charles Hewitt. I'm not sure if it's any relation of the other Hewitt who was, you know, friendly with Princess Diana. But anyway, he took over from Leo Cooper a book company called Pen and Sword Books. Leo Cooper was the husband of the writer Gilly Cooper, who lives up in Bisley here in Gloucestershire. And Charles Hewitt, though, changed his mind after I'd met him up in Barnsley. And I said, well, this is what I found out about Market Garden. He then sent me a very curt letter saying, oh, this is not going to I'm not interested in the book anymore. So he actually asked me to come up to Barnsley, which I did, because he was interested in me doing a book for Pen and Sword. And also, I was chatting to another writer who wrote a big book about the Nijmegen part of the Operation Market Garden, who said that he never goes along to the Market Garden anniversaries because they're too political. So obviously there is a lot of politics involved in this, and people who try and tell the truth, as I think his name was Cornelius Ryan, that did the amazing film A Bridge Too Far, all about the battle at the towards the end of the Second World War in Europe. The book, I wrote it anyway. So I thought, well, I don't need to get Pen and Sword to publish this. I've tried a few people to get to publish it without success so far. So I thought, well, I'm going to self-publish it. So as of tonight, you'll be able to download it off of our show page at thisweek.org.uk. It's called The Traitors of Arnhem, and it includes a lot of the research we've done, mainly me, Martin, with a guy called Dave Barmby, into the actual facts behind Operation Market Garden. It's a pretty incredible story in that there are some serious traitors at the very top of the British establishment, including the private secretary to Winston Churchill, a guy called Desmond Morton. But more importantly, on the battlefield itself, in September 1944, a guy called Boy Browning, who not only did he not, he was the leader of the airborne contingent in this assault in Holland in September 1944. He did not actually go to Arnhem. He went to Nijmegen instead. So it does suggest that he was rather nervous about going to Arnhem. You know, he should have been, as the leader of the airborne contingent, he should have been in Arnhem. But there's all sorts of stuff in this book. You'll find out all about that. But also, I pinned to it, Martin, the Martin Bormann timeline. So I wonder what you make of the connections between the expose about Martin Bormann being brought back to the UK by Ian Fleming's unit at the end of the Second World War and injecting a lot of money into the organised crime networks from the Nazi party who'd looted it from Europe. Martin Bormann, in a way, an interesting kind of linkage there between Adolf Hitler's private secretary, Bormann, and Winston Churchill's private secretary, Morton. But what about the connection, Martin, between what happened at the end of the war and what happened at Market Garden?
Well, I mean, over the years, you've done quite a lot of primary research on this, Tony, so I won't try and... I mean, if people are interested in this, they should obviously read what you've written about it, because there's an awful lot there for people to take on board. But the fundamental thing that people really need to take on board is that at the end of the Second World War, senior Nazis, including Reinhard Gehlen, there's no dispute about this, Reinhard Gehlen used to head up the Gestapo, he ends up heading the West German intelligence services. And so from the point of view of the Soviets, for example, it's absolutely clear what's happening here, that some people are being scapegoated, but in effect, the Nazis went underground and carried on functioning inside the Western alliance. And of course, people in Bolivia are very well aware of this, because Klaus Barbie was involved in the assassination of Che Guevara in 1967. Klaus Barbie was eventually extradited to France to stand trial as the Butcher of Lyon, but he'd been hidden in Latin America for years by the CIA, who brought him in to train the Bolivians in torture techniques. Now, this is absolutely on the record. It's not like the mysterious Illuminati or anything like that. It's absolutely clear. And if you talk to people in the street in Bolivia, they will tell you there's loads of ex-Croatian fascists there. A lot of them escaped on the rat lines to Latin America because they, of course, were Catholics and they got very good relations with the Vatican. So, I mean, this is what I regard as serious conspiracy theory, whereas talking about the days things happen and the numbers, less so.
Well, the book is called The Traitors of Arnhem. It's a final sort of definitive version. It's published today by me, and you could get it off of our website in a little, maybe in an hour, a couple of hours time, at thisweek.org.uk as a PDF file. I've got my watermark through there I'm going to publish a paid for version without the watermark, but it doesn't mean to say you can't read it. It's just this slightly annoying watermark, which will allow you to read it and have a look at it for free. And when that's available, hopefully, you know, I will make a little bit of money out of it. I do hope, because, you know, it's been sitting around, this book, for the last 4 or 5 years. And I've just basically run out of steam in trying to get it published. So that's the thing to do, isn't it, these days? Do a bit of self-publishing. Anyway, we're going to finish. I'm glad you mentioned the rat lines there, Martin, because we're going to finish with Archbishop Vigano addressing the Catholic Identity Conference this year, which is a few weeks ago, a week or maybe 10 days ago. And it's the rat lines were run basically by the Nazi Party and their liaisons within the Vatican. And there was a lot of involvement, as you just mentioned, the Croatian fascists, wasn't there, between the Vatican, between the Catholic Church, particularly the Vatican, and the Nazi Party?
Yeah, well, they had links with Mussolini, obviously, and then through the Croatians, links to the Nazis. A lot of the prominent people in the right wing in Bolivia are of Croatian origin from that era.
So, but thankfully, not the whole of the Catholic Church is run by Nazis.
You shouldn't presume that the Catholic Church is a monolith. It isn't.
It isn't, no.
And I used to work for the Catholic Fund for Overseas Development. I can tell you they're as divided as everybody else about most things.
One of the most courageous archbishops in the Catholic Church is this guy, Vigano, Archbishop Vigano, and he was one of the archbishops that was most critical of Pope Francis and his failure to address the paedophile issues within the Catholic Church. So anyway, he seems like one of the good guys, and he gave this address, which I thought was quite interesting, where he talks about links, what he believes are links between the present pandemic and the extension of COVID-19 to the New World Order. So let's have a listen to what he had to say about that now.
The subject of my thought would be how the revolution of Vatican II serves the New World Order. We live in extraordinary times. As each of us has probably understood, we find ourselves in a historical moment in time. Events of the past, which once seemed disconnected, prove now to be unequivocally connected, both in the principles that inspire them and in the goals they seek to achieve. A fair and objective look at the current situation cannot help but grasp the perfect coherence between the evolution of the global political framework and the role that the Catholic Church has assumed in the establishment of the New World Order. To be more precise, one should speak about the role of that apparent majority in the Church, which is actually small in number but extremely powerful, and which, for brevity's sake, I will summarize as the Deep Church. Obviously, there are not two churches, something that would be impossible, blasphemous, and heretical. Nor has the one true Christ Church today failed in her mission, perverting herself into a sect. The Church of Christ has nothing to do with those who, for the past 60 years, have executed a plan to occupy her. The overlap between the Catholic hierarchy and the members of the Deep Church is not a theological fact, but rather a historical reality that defies the usual categories and as such must be analyzed. We know that the New World Order project consists in the establishment of tyranny by Freemasonry, a project that dates back to the French Revolution, the Age of Enlightenment, the end of the Catholic monarchies, and the declaration of war on the Church. We can say that the New World Order is the antithesis of Christian society. It would be the realization of the diabolic Civitas Diaboli, the city of the devil, opposed to the Civitas Dei, the city of God, in the eternal struggle between the light and darkness, good and evil, God and Satan. In this struggle, Providence has placed the Church of Christ, and in particular the Supreme Pontiffs, as catechon, that is, the one who opposes the manifestation of the mystery of iniquity. Second letter to Thessalonians. And Sacred Scripture warns us that at the manifestation of the Antichrist, this obstacle, the catechon, will have ceased to exist. It seems quite evident to me that the end of times are now approaching before our eyes, since the mystery of iniquity has spread throughout the world with this appearance of the courageous opposition of the catechon. Let us not make the mistake of presenting the current events as normal, judging what happened with the legal, canonical, and sociological parameters that such normality would presuppose. In extraordinary time, and the present Christ in the Church is indeed extraordinary, events go beyond the ordinary known to our fathers.
Okay, so that's Archbishop Vigano addressing the Catholic Identity Conference, but lots in there. Just in a nutshell, Martin, is he a batty priest or what?
Well, I don't know. It's the first I've heard of him. So I'm trying to read him and where he's coming from.
Well, he's talking about, isn't he? He's talking about the Deep Church. He's basically saying, he's calling out his own institution and saying that, you know, parts of the Catholic Church have been occupied. He's also talking about the demise of the Catholic monarchies, the takeover of Freemasonry as he sees it. And he's now saying, well, this is the end of times.
Well, it's like a different version of what we heard earlier from our occultist friend. I don't tend to look at the world in that way. I tend to look at the world in terms of I think we are facing the end times. There's probably going to be a nuclear war. That's by far the most likely outcome of where we are. And in the 1960s and so on, we used to know that, but we've kind of forgotten it. And we're as close to it as we've ever been. And we don't really need the Illuminati or anything else to point it out to us. It's as clear as a nose on your face when we saw the B-52 bombers flying from Fairford the other week all along the Russian border, armed to the teeth with nuclear weapons. One slip and it would happen. That's how close we are.
Don't you think, though, that these sort of extreme measures, you know, they're getting rid of civil liberties, as we were saying earlier, the idea that, for example, they forgot to put anything about allowing protests into this latest lockdown legislation. So now apparently they're illegal as well. This is another form of oppression. It's not a nuclear war, but it has a very, very deep and powerful effect on domestic societies in a similar way to the war on terror had a horrific effect on the countries that where the United States was invading.
Well, I'll put another thing to you, Tony. If the banks collapse and the ATMs go down and people lose all of their savings in one go, would that be quite shocking to people? Where they've got no access to money at all, just like that, bang, that's how close we came. We came within a whisker of that.
Yeah, I mean, certainly with all these things happening together, you can see why a Catholic archbishop might be talking about the end of times. Anyway, time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest, that's Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and studio engineer Dave Bazanko. You can download our MP3s and listen in the car anywhere you like. You'll find this show's podcast, story links and comment page and our contact details and that of the station that removed us back in March if you wish to contact them at thisweekoneword.org.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. This show is rebroadcast at 9 p.m. On this channel at PRSC Radio Stream and at midnight Friday on the PRSC Stream. Over Sunday lunch in two places, from noon at richieallen.co.uk and at radioquk.com on Sunday too at noon. Feel free to download and rebroadcast this show, complete anywhere you like. I just request you credit this show to This Week, the show page, thisweek.org.uk. You can hear the glorious sounds of Danny Lopsch at Sunday evenings at 6 on BCFM. Do please join us for the Politics Show live stream. Not the BCFM Politics Show live stream at 5 o'clock next Friday. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
Whoop, whoop. That's the sound of the police. Whoop, whoop. That's the sound of the beast. Whoop, whoop. That's the sound of the police. Whoop, whoop. That's the sound of the beast. Whoop, whoop. That's the sound of the police. That's the sound of the beast. Whoop, whoop. That's the sound of the police. Whoop, whoop. That's the sound of the beast. Stand clear, done man attack. You can't stand where I stand, you can't walk where I walk. Watch out, we run New York. Policeman come, we bust him off the park. I know this for a fact, you don't like how I act. You be doing that. I gotta say see ya, cause I would never be ya. Be your officer, your wicked overseer. Your hot shot, wanna get props and be a savior. First show a little respect, change your behavior. Change your attitude, change your plan. There could never really be justice or stolen land. Are you really for peace and equality? Or when my car's hooked up, you know you wanna follow me. Your laws are minimal, cause you won't even think about looking at the real criminal. This has got to cease, cause we be getting hyped to the sound of the police. Whoop, whoop. That's the sound of the police. Whoop, whoop. That's the sound of the beast. Whoop, whoop. That's the sound of the police. Whoop, whoop. That's the sound of the beast. There's a little truth. Open up your eye while you're checking out the boombox. Check the exercise. Check the word overseer. Like a sample, repeat it very quickly and approve for example. Overseer, overseer.
I walk around with a bigger one. I hear it all day, just so they can run the light and be upon their way.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed.
That's the sound of the police. That's the sound of the bees. That's the sound of the police. That's the sound of the bees. Check out the message in a rough style. The real criminal on the COP. You check for undercover anyone, DG. But just got me a black man, they won't check me. They check out me job, for it shine like the sun. But them jealous of them next guy, they got a board work. Black people still slaves up to today. But the black police officer, let's see it that way. He wants a salary, he wants it. So he put on a badge and kill people for it. That's the sound of the beast.